Good evening, everyone. Welcome to National Liberty Alliance's Monday night conference call. Today is Monday, was it the 28th, I think. I didn't look at today's date. Yep, 28th, 2016. Hey, Jan, am I coming through clear? Am I loud enough?
Yes, you sound fine. Loud and clear.
Thank you. Okay, anyway, we broadcast live every Monday from 9 p.m. Eastern to midnight. If you're listening over another network and you would like to ask a question or make a comment, our call-in number is 712-770-4160, and our participant code is 385-698. If anyone would like to email a question, you can send the questions to nationallibertyalliance.org. Also, please support our business partners. See the banners on our right-hand side of our website, of which the proceeds go to support NLA's effort to save America. Also, please support NLA by donating $5 a month or more. Check on our donation tab on the top right-hand side of our website. Okay, tonight's scripture reading is Leviticus chapter 26, verses 1 through 13. Leviticus chapter 26, verses 1 through 13. Let me make sure that was the one I wanted to read. I think it is. Okay. Ye shall make you no idols, nor graven images, neither rear up a standing image. Neither shall ye set up any image of stone in your land, or bow down unto it. For I am Jehovah your God. Ye shall keep my Sabbaths and reverence my sanctuary. I am Jehovah. If you walk in my statutes and keep my commandments and do them, then I will give you rain in due season, and the land shall yield her increase, and the trees of the field shall yield their fruit, and your threshing shall reach into the vintage, and the vintage shall reach into the sowing time, and ye shall eat your bread to the full, and dwell in your land safely. And I will give you peace in the land, and ye shall lie down, and none shall make ye afraid. And I will rid the evil beast out of the land, neither shall the sword go through your land. And if ye shall chase your enemies, and they shall fall before you by the sword, and five of you will chase 100, and 100 of you shall put 10,000 to flight, and your enemies shall fall before you by the sword. For I will have respect unto you, and make you fruitful, and multiply you, and establish my covenant with you. And ye shall eat old store, and bring forth the old because of the new. And I will set my tabernacle among you, and my soul shall not abhor you. And I will walk among you, and will be your God, and ye shall be my people. I am Jehovah your God, which brought you forth out of the land of Egypt, that ye should not be their bondage. And I have broken the bands of your yoke, and made you to go upright. Okay, that was Leviticus chapter 26, verses 1 through 13. All right, let's see. Oh, before we move on to anything, I thought I saw a question. Was there a question laying about somewhere, Jan? Anybody mail something in?
We had a couple. One was for Brent, so I can save that for later. There was one that says, if the two common law maximums that state for there to be a crime, there must be a victim, and for every injury, there must be a remedy, that everyone, without exception, is subject to in our country, then how can anyone who's been pardoned not have to restore their victims? This seems to fly in the face of our laws and the face of God's laws. As a result, it seems to approach the Vicar of Christ stuff that Brent Winter speaks about. So I guess this actually went to Brent as well. Like when the Pope
Yeah, I would agree with
like
that. They,
yeah. Okay.
The government right. does not have the ability to dismiss people who are indebted because they injured them and have to pay restitution. The government cannot decide on, well, look, I'll make a deal with you, and, you know, after the grand jury indicts. The grand jury indicts, only the grand jury can make the deal or the arrangement, but it has to be satisfactory to the injured party. So, yeah, those things cannot be done under common law.
Right.
All right, I'll let Brent answer that, too, maybe, and anything else he's got. All right, that was it? That was the only thing you had?
Okay. No, the other one was directly Brent, yeah.
Okay, so there's nothing else for me, right?
Nope, nothing there.
Okay. By the way, is Gerard on? I think he was having trouble with his Skype or something.
I saw him earlier anyway.
I'm here.
Okay, good. All right, because I'm going to try to bail out a little early. I'm really tired. I've been up early this morning. I was up late last night, and we've been writing, and, goodness, I got a stack of papers in my hand. I was going to read this whole thing. I started reading it into a recorder so I could just play the recorder. And I was an hour and a half and still had some pages left. And I decided, well, I'm going to skip that idea. But this paper needs to be read by everyone. I'm going to kind of just generally go through the paper and read parts of the paper, particularly the end. I might read maybe 8 or 9 pages. I don't know how many pages, but again, I'm just going to generally go through it. You can get a copy of this at nationallibertyalliance.org. Go to highlight grand jury, come down to grand jury, highlighting grand jury under grand jury, and click on docket. When I get a chance, I'm going to move this page right under the first drop down. So as soon as it drops down, it'll be under that list, and you'll just see docket. But for right now, that's how you get to it. And the paper we're going to read is labeled Redress of Grievances to the President-elect. Redress of Grievances to President-elect. Now, we've been writing papers now for weeks, and this is a paper. It's got 36 pages to it, and I'm not going to read all 36 pages. It's going to take more than half of our programming to do that. But generally, most people that visit us, they know what's going on, so we can kind of breeze through some of this stuff. And specifically, in the beginning of this paper, all of our papers are educational, informative, informational, and we also try to make them demanding requirements of the obedience to the law. This paper is no different, and even more so with President-elect Trump. He's not in office yet. We're going to be sending his papers out as soon as we can. We do have a lot of Congress done already, which as soon as we get that done, maybe we'll read that next week. And I think we'll have the governors done by next week. We may go through both of them and kind of just review. I'm not sure how we'll handle that, but we do want to get those papers out. And then we have one going to the governor, then we got one going to the judiciary. And maybe through this week we can get those three papers done, because Congress is almost done, and the governors might give us a little bit of difficulty, but that'll be a little short. The judiciary would be real simple, because we've written a lot of papers to them, and we can kind of bring the major points up and make them to respond to what we're doing. Our case will consist of these four papers, particularly, again, one going to the president, two going to Congress, both houses, one going to the judiciary, and another going to all 50 governors. Each governor will be the same. The only change we'll make is in the name of the governor in the state, and of course, and that'll be it. I think we're going to try our best, and hopefully we're going to have enough money to do this. We do need money to do all this, so please, anybody that can give, give some money here. Anybody that's not given $5 a month or more, please, really seriously, consider giving us that money, because we need that to operate, and we need it to do paperwork and file paperwork in the courts. Okay? I'm expecting to try to certify every one of these papers. It should be 50 papers going to the governors. Two go into the Congresses, so that's 52. We want one to the U.S. Supreme Court, 53, and one to the president-elect, so that's, 54. Let me think if there's anyone else. The three branches, president, yeah, that's it. So about 54. So the cost for registering these letters, these papers, and the cost of mailing is probably going to be about $6-7 a piece at least. Because the weight's going to be a little hefty on some of these, or most of these, or whatever. Some of these are going to be pretty hefty weights. I'm not sure. So let's say $5 average. So it gives you an idea, $5 times 54, let's say 55 mailings. So that runs up to a few $100, maybe $300 or something, whatever that math runs out to be. Then, of course, there's paper and toner. I already bought all the toner for this. I'm going to work on buying the paper now and get a couple of reams and a couple of cases of reams. I buy by the box, 10-ream boxes, so we'll buy 20 reams. I go through a lot of paper because we do a lot of mailing, a lot of writing. All of the papers that we have filed, we mentioned this before, there are about 18 or 20 of them. They're all going to be filed into this court, refiled into this one court, and served onto all of these people again. That'll be separate mailings as we move along. In this court case, we will be doing indictments. We're going to be talking with the president about that. We're working on a line to the president. We do have a sort of a channel to him, and hopefully we'll pick up a dialogue with him. That would be really great if we can. He does seem to want to make America great, and we're going to tell him what he needs to do to make America great. He needs to obey the law and require everyone that he is within his power to do so, to require them to obey the law. There are, I forget, I don't know, 15 or so cabinet members, something like that, 16, I don't remember the number. But there's so many cabinet members under the president, and he picks the secretaries, this is his cabinet, and each one of those individuals controls certain types or numbers of different federal agencies. So all federal agencies answer directly to the president ultimately in an indirect way. President makes his will to be known, makes his orders, passes it down to the cabinet. The cabinet passes it down accordingly to the different agencies, and so on. So everything that's been happening that's been evil, everything that's been happening that's been wrong and abusive to the people, especially what's going on out west, but not just there, it's all across the nation, all of that stuff is because the president has allowed it. The president knows what's going on. These cabinet members know what's going on. The orders have gone out to be nasty in order to take over the land for land grabs. That's what it's all about. Well, we're expecting this president to be quite different and to put the law of the land, the law of the people, the fear of the people into the hearts of these people. And that's what this paper is all about. It's the most important papers we've written to date. This is where we've been working to get to. We're working towards the critical mass. We're very close. I think once we make the connection, if we make a good, solid connection with the president, which we intend on doing that, once we get all these papers together, we will be delivering to him both around the corner, so to speak, through a secondary individual into the administration. And then, of course, we will be mailing it to him also certified, because he needs to answer this as president-elect. I'm going to read some of the pages here. Again, if you want to follow along, go up to nationallibertyalliance.org, highlight grand jury, highlight the second grand jury underneath it, click on docket, and on the left side you'll see court filings. Click on redress of grievances, president-elect. If you keep an eye on this page, you'll see papers are constantly being added. I'm sure we're going to add maybe another three or four, maybe five pages, papers up coming up the next week. We've got evidence documents that we've been piling up. We've got law documents we'll be using, the court filings. We also will be filing all of the habeas corpuses that we've been filing that have been gone on, and we've sent them contempt of court, and they still sit there in silence. Now it's time for them to answer. We're going to have them show cause by what authority they think that they can disregard the Fifth Amendment. So we'd like to really know where they get that ability. So, and we're going to go after these people. And once we send forth an indictment, we don't need anyone to go out and arrest these people right away. I mean, if we can get that to happen, that's fine. But we don't need that. We can make the indictment. Once we make the indictment and we prepare the case, we're going to bring it into the court case that we have. After all, these are extraordinary measures that we had to take because our government has really shut off the people. They're not hearing the voice of the people. We're really counting on this president to hear the voice of the people, to do the right thing, to obey the law at all costs. It doesn't matter. No matter what threat, and I think this man is ready to do it, no matter what threat they put upon him, he's ready to go forward. He knows that we're about ready to lose everything. He knows it's do or die right now. It doesn't matter. You know, he's going to die. Well, a lot of us are going to die. We'll be gotten rid of many different ways if we don't make this change now. And if we hit him hard, more than they even realize, hit them hard in the courts, hit them hard with the president working off the bully pulpit, pressing upon Congress and pressing upon the judiciary. If we can get the judiciary to start to really fear, which I think now they're starting to already fear. They're fearing our papers, but they've been going along anyway. Now with this president-elect Trump, it's a whole new story. They know big changes are coming. And when they see these new papers going on and they read the papers concerning what we sent to the president, and depending on what he does in his inauguration, we're going to be watching and listening to exactly what he has to say during his inauguration. We also are going to pay attention to his actions in the first 100 days. We're going to be looking for executive orders to fix things, make them right. So all of this pressure, I think, is 5 will chase 100 and 100 will chase 10,000. And so on. If we keep them constantly on the defense and we stay on the offense, and we can stay on the offense, they will not be able to collect themselves together to actually plan something decisive. Because first of all, they're full of a lot of bureaucracy. They too have to come to meetings and they have to collect someplace physically, geographically. Okay, and they have to make decisions. And they have to make decisions on the latest things. And if we are pumping and pumping and pumping and hitting and hitting and hitting, they don't have the opportunity to reset themselves, to gain what it is they need in order to deal with the problems that they're going to have to deal with once we start pushing the law and requiring that the law, the obedience of the law, be paid. Judges, I think, will start to fear. There'll be some collapses. We will start cases within our cases. At that point, they will have to come, they will have to answer, and they will be sitting, there will be a sitting trial jury there, a trial jury that will be chosen under common law and not the law of men. So we have a lot of hope in this. We have a lot of plans. There's a lot of ideas. Again, it's extraordinary measures and extraordinary times. But everything we're doing is logical, and there's process and procedure for everything we're doing. So let's see how they're going to deal with this. Once they realize they can't be protected, they should be abandoning ship. Of course, some of them are so evil, they're probably going to abandon the country. They may have to just leave and try to find an island. But we'll get to them. We'll find them. And we'll bring them to justice. Okay. So this is a paper. Again, let me make one more last call. You can find a copy of this paper up on National Liberty Alliance under grand jury documents. And it's under court filings, and it's labeled redress of grievances, president-elect. Okay? All right. Now, this is United States District Court. It's going to be the Northern District of New York. And we're hoping in the next 7 to 10 days to file this. I mean, again, you know, my eyes are killing me all day because I've been reading and writing and reading and writing and reading and writing and involved with all this and trying to put these things together. But I'll be every day this week, we'll be doing the same thing, reading and writing, reading and writing, reading and writing to get these papers up and going and done. We're not lost with the bureaucracy or the insanity of a lot of these bar attorneys, you know, with their processes and all their garbage that they have to deal with. You know, we go right to the point and we're talking about real law of the land, which is really simple once you become familiar with it. It's called the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, the Declaration of Independence, the Magna Carta, and, of course, the Holy Bible. Okay, grand jury, we the people, against all four branches of government. In this case, this particular paper is directed to the president-elect, Donald Trump, ETAL, respondents. Et al. Means that there's a bunch of other people behind, or at least more than one person behind this person's name. Et al., ETAL. This is both an information and a redress of grievances. We state for quite clearly jurisdiction is a court of record under the rules of common law. We use the necessary federal forms. I forget the form number, 150, 160 or something. I don't remember. But we do have it up here on a page. If anybody wants to look at it, go to the docket page and you'll see there's a statement of jurisdiction. And that's a federal form, that statement of jurisdiction. I got it open, so it's Federal Form 7, page 106, written by the 113th Congress in the second session. And this provides us for a statement of jurisdiction. So we're going to let them know. This is under the law of the land, also known as common law. Okay, so it's an information. It's directed to the president-elect. And I'll read the first page, and we're going to skip around as we go, and I'll try to kind of just give a little synopsis of what we're skipping, if I can recall. We, the people of the United States of America, under the power and the authority of the sureties of peace, the grand jury, here and after, we the people, whereas the unified common law grand juries arose out of we the people in each of the 50 states, forming unified common law grand juries in each state, which came together to form the unified United States common law grand jury. This was done in an effort to seduce subversion against the United States of America from enemies both foreign and domestic within our governments, both federal and states. This court of record, proceeding according to the common law for the redress of grievances, which is our unalienable right, has we ordained and expressed in writing the Bill of Rights, ratified on December 15th, 1791, in order to prevent misconstruction or abuse of federal government powers, we the people established Amendment 1. Congress shall make no law respecting the right of the people to petition the government for redress of grievances. This is the beginning of that restoration. Elected and appointed servants have a duty to speak. When the master requires his servants to give an account of their stewardship, they ought to answer straightway. Said servants have been vested with authority and powers, not bar attorneys. When it comes to giving an accountant by those who have been vested with powers, there can be no right to remain silent, and there can be no right to answer through counsel. When the grand jury calls, there are no attorneys permitted to speak on behalf of the individuals called. This is especially true when vested servants are called to give an account. We are the grand jury, and we are calling, and you must respond to our list of objections and be restored under the law of the land, resign, or be indicted for subversion. Silence, this is a quote from U.S. versus Tweel, silence can only be equated with fraud, where there is a legal or moral duty to speak. We have vested these people with powers, we've given them authority, and they must answer. If they remain silent, they've got to give up their post, and we'll go after them for fraud, because silence is equivalent to fraud. They're guilty of something, and we will find out what it is. Silence can only be equated with fraud where there is a legal or moral duty to speak, or where an inquiry left unanswered would be intentionally misleading. If said servants cannot understand the plain language of we the people in this action, then that is proof positive that they violated their oath. If said servant does not know the law of the land, how can they govern, not knowing their jurisdiction? Said servants pursued the positions that they now occupy and are therefore expected to know these things. We, the people, will not accept ignorance as an excuse. We will, however, forgive your trespasses if you confess your trespasses and restore yourself under the law of the land. Of course, if there's a injured individual, that's a whole different story altogether. We can't do anything about that when that comes up. The resolve of this information and this court of record is to educate and inform our elected and appointed servants, the people and President-elect Donald Trump, hereinafter President-elect, of the intentions of we the people to restore this nation back to its roots and honor the covenant we made with nature's God in 1776. We intend on doing this through revealing in this court of record said subverts within our government and indicting them as we amass the critical mass necessary to take back our courts and make America great again. We perceive you understand that all the problems America faces today initiated through ignorance of the common law, also known as the law of the land. That perpetual light that once guided us through the darkness and weathered the storms that now have eroded our blessings of liberty, which is not possible to comprehend or achieve without that light. We have lost our way, and our light has become like a candle in the wind. Thomas Jefferson said, God, who gave us life, gave us liberty. And can the liberties of a nation be thought secured when we have removed their only firm basis, a conviction in the minds of the people that these liberties are a gift of God, that they are not to be violated but by with his wrath? Indeed, I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just, that his justice cannot sleep forever. Thomas Jefferson. Before honor stands humility. We the people come in both and expect our president-elect to do likewise. You have taken on a sacred duty to make America great again, and in an office that for many years has been the enemy of the aforesaid light, and without the guiding light as a lamp upon our feet, we cannot achieve our goal. You must act under the law of the land. You must understand that only the people can save America, and only by rallying the people around that light, which is the law of the land, can America be great again and keep it. This now is your duty, Mr. President-elect. Thomas Jefferson said, educate and inform the whole masses of the people. They are the only sure reliance for the preservation of our liberty. It is your duty. It is our duty, by the way, every single person here and me. It is your duty to become educated, to understand, to be able to pick that sword of righteousness and take down these people, which is the pen, which is the word, which is in our courts of justice. An enlightened citizenry is indispensable for the proper functioning of a republic. Self-government is not possible unless the citizens are educated sufficiently to enable them to exercise oversight. It is therefore imperative that the nation see to it that a suitable education be provided for all of its citizens.
John,
that flickering,
Your mic is a little bit staticky. I don't know if you've changed batteries or something lately.
Yeah, let me take a quick look. All right, what I'll do is I'll put on my wire set. Let me change mics. Hang on.
That'd be good.
Is this any better? Testing 1, 2. Can you hear me now?
Yep, that's good.
It's good? Okay. Okay, maybe it didn't charge all the way. Let me see. Okay, that flickering light can only burn bright again if the people wax great in the knowledge of the common law. They need to understand that the power and the ability of the people to have government by consent can only be achieved through the exercising of that law. And only then can we secure liberty again. As Jefferson said, if a people expect to be ignorant and free, they expect what never was and will never be. This government, any government that wants to enslave its people, enjoys slaves who can think as slaves and don't have a free mind. They can think they have a free mind. They understand nothing. They have no knowledge of law. They have no knowledge of process. And once they're caught under the iron grip they'll never get out.
You're back to where it's distorting on maximum volume again, John. I don't know what's going on. Maybe you got a bad line or something.
Yeah, I don't know. Is anyone else out there experiencing the same thing? Gerard, are you experiencing the same problem?
Gerard, can you hear it? Or Robert? Very quiet on the Western Front.
Yeah. Well, who else is here? Gerard, you're not there? Robert? All right. Is it getting any better? Or?
Well, when you're not talking too loud, it's fine. It's on the maximum volume that it distorts.
Oh, well, maybe I can lower my volume. Maybe that's the thing. Let me go
knock
to my
your
tools
gain down
here.
A little, yeah. Right.
Yeah, let me see if that'll do
that
it.
That might work.
Okay,
again,
let's see. Yeah, this is... Okay, how's that?
Distortion?
Is that better?
It's okay
is this
now.
Better? Okay,
okay
I lowered
right.
my volume.
Okay.
I lowered my volume. Let me know if it happens again, and I'll lower it again. So we'll see how this goes. Okay. Mr. President-elect, you will surround yourself with many advisors and legal counselors, and we, the people, submit to you that the bar advice subverts the common law. Administrations before you have seized power and taken control of our legislators and our courts. America has been governed by an oligarchy and maintains its power through these minions of the New World Order, also known as bar attorneys, and the Fed, the former controlling our courts, the latter our financial and political process. See Congressman McFadden's speech on the Federal Reserve Corporation. You can find that on our docket page here on NLA, National Liberty Alliance. We, the people, by the mercy of God, humbly offer our advice and understanding of the law, for we, the people, limited law, making powers to ourselves alone. Woe versus Hopkins. Sovereignty itself is, of course, not subject to the law, for it is the author and source of law. But in our system, which sovereign powers are delegated to the agencies of government, sovereignty itself remains with the people, by whom and for whom all government exists and acts. And the law is the definition and limitation of power. Of course, that would be through the Constitution. Again, Yickwo versus Hopkins. I'm coming. Still coming in okay now?
It's pretty good now.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, you're fine. Yeah.
Okay, the Lord has taught us correction is grievous to those who have forsaken the way. And he who hears correction receives understanding. He that refuses instruction despises his own soul, but he that hears reproof receives understanding. Thomas Jefferson said, I know of no other safe depository of the ultimate power of the society but the people themselves. And if we think them not enlightened enough to exercise their control with a wholesome discretion, the remedy is not to take it from them, but to inform their discretion by education. This is the true corrective of abuses of constitutional power. That's how we correct it. Become educated, understand, and know the law. And let's hold their feet to the fire. Okay, we the people have created a place to educate and inform the people and our servants at nationallibertyalliance.org. And we advise you, Mr. President-elect, to support the people by simply obeying the law and using the bully pulpit of your office to lead our legislative and judicial branches to do the same. And then and only then will we the people bind them with the chains of the Constitution and enjoy the fruits of liberty again. George Washington warned, government is like fire, a dangerous servant and a fearful master. Thomas Jefferson counseled us and said, in questions of power, let no more be heard of the confidence in man, but bind him down from the mischiefs by the chains of the Constitution. Okay, now the next section is quite a few pages. It goes into the federal agencies that have become militarized and they're out of control. And we've got a lot of information in here. Everyone should read this paper. And you should read it numerous times. This is an education. This paper in itself is an education. Every paper we have is an education. And collectively, it's an education sufficient enough to give you an understanding of the process and the procedures of the courts, specifically in the federal courts and the state courts, understanding jurisdiction and due process and how you can take control of the court. All of that is learned by simply reading and understanding these papers, looking at the footnotes. Read, understand the meanings of these things. Don't presume anything. Read, double-check it, and see what the legal meanings of these words and phrases are we're using. Also, of course, our civics course and our constitutional course, you combine all that together, and you are sufficient enough knowledge to be able to articulate and deal in a court. But understanding is the key. Above all, get understanding. Okay. We talk about federal agencies that have been militarized. I mean, it goes on and on and on. I might read a paragraph here or two. Let me read a couple of paragraphs, at least in the beginning of this, but I'm going to jump ahead a lot of this because it's way too much. But again, on your own, this is your education. This is what you need to know and understand. All federal agents are under the control of the president, and with the exception of appointed officers, see Marbury versus Madison, that means judges and U.S. marshals, the clerks, certain individuals that are officers of the court, they are appointed and they cannot be removed from office by nobody. Only Congress can remove them, or we the people can remove them through an indictment. Okay, with the exception of appointed officers, see Marbury versus Madison, all serve at his pleasure. Therefore, it stands to reason that the agencies reflect the morals and the will of the administration. Militarized units from government agencies are wreaking havoc on nonviolent citizens. Dozens of federal agencies now have special weapons and tactics, SWAT teams, MRAPs and APCs, to further an expanding definition of their missions. Department of Agriculture, the Railroad Retirement Board, Tennessee Valley Authority, the Office of Personal Management, the Consumer Product Safety Commission, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. All of these have their own SWAT teams. Law enforcement agencies across the United States at every level of government have been blurring the lines between police officer and soldier. The war on drugs and more recently post 9/11 anti-terrorism efforts have created a new figure on the U.S. scene, the militarized warrior cop, ready to deal harshly with targeted wrongdoers and a growing threat to familiar American liberties. The proliferation of paramilitary federal SWAT teams inevitably brings abuses that have nothing to do with either drugs or terrorism. Many of the raids they conduct are against harmless, often innocent Americans who typically are accused of nonviolent civil or administrative violations. Okay, then we give a lot of examples here, and I'm going to start skipping a lot of this stuff here. Maybe just look for key paragraphs that I might want to read. Okay, on page 36, top, we're going to read, as the U.S. engages in national debate over the militarization of police, federal data allows that government agencies charged with largely administrative roles are spending tens of millions of taxpayer dollars to purchase SWAT and military-style equipment. Since 2006, 44 traditionally administrative agencies have spent over $71 million on items like body armor, riot helmets, and shields, cannon launchers, and police firearms, and ammunition. According to the federal spending data from the watchdog group OpenTheBook.com, this comes in addition to the $330 million spent on such equipment in that period by traditional law enforcement agencies like the FBI, Secret Service, and Drug Enforcement Administrations. Okay, the next paragraph talks about, let me read the next paragraph. It raised many eyebrows when we learned last week that the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration received 46,000 rounds of ammunition. This revelation, which we are now told was a clerical error, comes on the heels of the Social Security Administration procuring 174,000 rounds of .357 125 grain bonded jacket hollow point pistol ammunition. All this leads to the question, why do so many federal agents need bullets? Okay, down another couple paragraphs. The growth of the federal law enforcement bureaucracy has jumped dramatically over the last 20 years. There are 73 federal agencies that have full-time armed officers, often called special agents, that have arresting authority. All of these agencies now cordon off and enforce a federal fiefdom. Is that how to pronounce that? Fiefdom, right? Fiefdom. Of the more than 4,500 criminal laws at the federal level and thousands of additional regulations that have sprung up in recent decades. According to the 2008 DOJ Federal Law Enforcement Report, this is 2008, there were 120,000 full-time law enforcement officers working for the federal agency. And that's back in 2008. And Obama has been building his military force that is not a military force. You know, people more just as armed, just as well. I forget what it is. We have that written down. We'll read that a little later, that quote of his. But that's an army right there, 120,000 federal agents is an army. They're all being militarized. Why? And they're out abusing the people, getting used to abusing the people. This has got to stop. Okay, let's skip some pages here because, again, there's so much here that we just can't read it all. I'm going to go to the solution on page 10. I'm just going to read a few spaces up. Officers in full SWAT gear from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Services stormed the home of Kathy and George Norris. The agents instigated the raid for George's failure to file the proper paperwork for orchards he imported. Kathy and George were grandparents in their 60s when the raid took place. The EPA led a joint raid along with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Bureau of Land Management, the Coast Guard, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and the U.S. Park Service on a mining operation for possible violations of a Clear Waters Act. The Bureau of Land Management had a long standoff with Clive and Bundy, a rancher, because he grazed his cattle on federal lands, of course, federal lands that he had control of. Under the 2002 Homeland Security Act, we have seen a massive expansion of police activities carried out by federal agencies. The agents carrying these activities generally like the form of militarized SWAT teams. This has left Americans wondering why officials from the Department of Education or EPA are barging into their homes and businesses dressed in full SWAT gear. Solution. Our framers faced these same abuses at the hand of the British military during the lead-up of the Revolutionary War. They designed the Constitution to protect us from these abuses. We should support a common-sense law like the Regulatory Agency Demilitarization Act because it would do much to protect us from these abuses. In 2014, Representative Chris Stewart, Republican from Utah, sponsored the Regulatory Agency Demilitarization Act, which would have removed arresting authority from agencies not traditionally authorized to carry weapons or make arrests. In a press release announced the bill, Representative Stewart said, "When they are generally dangerous situations involving federal laws, that the job of the Department of Justice, not regulatory agencies like the FDA or the Department of Education, not only is it overkill, but having these heavily armed units within dozens of agencies is duplicative, costly, heavy-handed, dangerous, and destroys any sense of trust between the citizens and the federal government. Mr. President-elect, having a majority in both houses, should use the bully pulpit to lead our legislative branch to support this sentiment." Okay, then we go into the right of privacy versus NSA spying. And we get into a lot of different things here. Let me see. I don't know how much I'm going to read of this. I'll read a paragraph or two. Let's see where we go. National Security Agency is under the control of the president and serves as at his pleasure. According to the Times, Bush, under the color of law, signed a presidential order in 2002 allowing NSA to monitor without a warrant the international and sometimes domestic telephone calls and email messages of hundreds of thousands of citizens and legal residents inside the United States. This shocking abuse of power eventually came to include some purely internal controls, but no requirement that warrants be obtained from the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, as the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution and the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Law require. In other words, there is no independent review of judicial oversight. The idea that the president claims that he is not bound by that law is simply astounding and nothing short of presidential power grab. This thing goes on and on and on about all of the control and all of the spying. They spy on every electronic message that goes anywhere across any wires or even across the air through cell. It doesn't matter. They get everything. They are spying on every single person in the United States of America. If you send email, they have a copy of it. If you talk on a phone, they have a copy of the audio. If you, whatever you do on your computer, they know exactly. It's all copied. Keystrokes are hit, copied. They have even streetlights in numerous cities. There's three or four cities that were mentioned. And even streetlights have equipment on it that are new equipment that has face recognition. And they're monitoring the people as they move throughout the city. They're able to follow individuals. Everything is being recorded and put into this huge supercomputer. And when you become a person of interest, they know everything about you, and they can pull everything out. A government should not be doing this to their people. Why are they doing this? That's the question we have to ask. But it goes on and on and on. Let's read what our founding fathers had to say about some of this stuff on page 12. Only we the people lose, this is the bottom, only we the people lose the essential unalienable right of privacy. We lose once we the people lose the essential unalienable right of privacy, we lose everything. Our founding fathers warned us about governments eroding our rights, and it seems that nothing has changed. Patrick Henry said, guard with jealousy attention the public liberty. Suspect everyone who approaches that jewel. Unfortunately, nothing will preserve it but downright force. Whenever you give up that force, you are inevitably ruined. Thomas Paine said, the greatest tyrants are always perpetrated in the name of the most noblest causes. James Madison says, if tyranny and oppression come to this land, it will be in the guise of fighting a foreign enemy. Does all this sound familiar? Or is it just me here? I don't know. James Madison said, the means of defense against foreign danger historically have become the instruments of tyranny at home. President Herbert Hoover said, every collectivist revolution rides in on a Trojan horse of emergency. It was a tactic of Lenin, Hitler, and Mussolini. Benjamin Franklin said, those who would give up essential liberty to purchase a little temporary safety deserves neither liberty or safety. Thomas Jefferson said, I prefer dangerous freedoms over peaceful slavery. He also said, I would rather be exposed to the inconveniences attending to too much liberty than to those attending to too small a degree of it. Again, Patrick Henry said, is life so dear or peace so sweet as to purchase at the price of chains and slavery? Forbid it, Almighty God. I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty or give me death. General Douglas MacArthur said, our government has kept us in perpetual state of fear, keeps us in a continuous stampede of patriotic fever with the cry of grave national emergencies. Always there has been some terrible evil at home or some monstrous foreign power that was going to gobble us all up. If we did not blindly rally behind it by furnishing the exorbitant funds demanded, Yet in retrospect, these disasters never seem to have happened, seem never to have been quite real. Daniel Webster said, good intentions will always be the plea for every assumption of authority. It is hardly too strong to say that the Constitution was made to guard the people against the dangers of good intentions. There are men in all ages whose means to govern well, but they mean to govern. They promise to be good masters, but they mean to be masters. And one other, American jurisprudence, no one is bound to obey an unconstitutional law, and no courts are bound to enforce it. Okay, it goes on and on and on, as terrorist things, talks about the Constitution, all of these different agencies, and tells some different stories and reports. Just goes on and on and on, page after page after page. At one point, I thought it was too much, but you know what? We have to make it overwhelming. We have to make it realized in the mind of the reader, which we expect the president-elect to be that leader, realizes that how seriously defunct this country has come, how far off base, how far outside of their jurisdictions they act. What is their purpose to want to know everything about we the people? What is their purpose to have the federal agencies militarized? Over 120,000, that was 2008. That was before, you know, this president, the past, is talking about building this, home, what did he call it? Again, we'll get to it at the end. I don't remember what he called it. It is said here by a former senior administration officer. He says, it's breathtaking. This is page 18. It's breathtaking in its scope, said a former senior administration official familiar with the White House debate, who also notes gazillions. He uses the word gazillions. That's the number of times the federal government has spied on Americans since 9/11 through the use of drones, legal search warrants, illegal search warrants, federal agents' written search warrants, and just plain government spying. This is according to Senator Rand Paul, Republican of Kentucky, when he asked the government to tell him what it was doing to violate our privacy, he was given a classified briefing. Rand Paul, who is just one of a few in the U.S. Senate who believes that the Constitution means what it says, was required by federal law to agree not to reveal what spies, the bureaucrats, spies and bureaucrats told him during the briefing. Okay, and it goes on and on. The IRS, different programs, the Central Intelligence Agency, the TIA. The CIA, the NASA, the FBI, goes on and on and on. Drones, wiretapping, wire reports, the security. Let's see. Moving on to page 22. Page 23, as Christian Post wrote, your constitutional rights have been repealed in 10 states. Did you know that? There are 10 states where you cannot have constitutional rights. And they're making use of that. No, this isn't a joke. It is not an exaggeration or hyperbole. If you are in 10 states in the United States, some of your rights guaranteed by the Bill of Rights have been made null and void. If you live in Hawaii, or Maine, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Delaware, Rhode Island, Connecticut, Florida, Michigan, or New Jersey, congratulations. It does not matter where you go in your state, the Department of Homeland Security can come in and demand to search your electronic devices. They do not need any cause. Those states listed are only the ones that are totally covered by these border security search zones. And we have a copy of that map. You can see this map. We have a copy of that map up on our website, on our docket page, and it's called No Free Speech Zones. Other states like New York, Pennsylvania, Virginia have massive parts of their states that are covered by this too. Wired pointed out in 2008 that the courts have routinely upheld such constitutional free zones. Clearly, past administrations are guilty of warring against we the people, and if America is to become great again, it will require nothing short of the president-elect and his administration working with we the people to end the subversion and bring these traitorous servants to justice. We the people continue with an olive branch and will not pursue indictments against any public servant that cooperates with us to the end, to end this Orwellian nightmare. But the mighty hand of justice surely will come down upon those who resist, resolute in the utmost consequences and without mercy. Then we talk about the destruction of the balance of power. This is an extremely important one, and people really need to understand and get their head wrapped around this. And if you don't understand what we're talking about here, go back and reread this and go to the Constitution and read that part. And we have it listed in here. This is the destruction of the balance of power. Our Constitution provided, and this is how we can overcome this. This is one of the main reasons we're writing to the governors. We need to alert them on how they can take power and authority back from this federal government, this out-of-control federal government. Destruction of the balance of power. This is on page 24. Our Constitution provided for a balance of power that was laid waste by an unratified, unconstitutional 17th Amendment, which was specifically forbidden by the Constitution of itself, and therefore is null and void. Now, pay very close attention to what the Constitution says. It's almost, you kind of pass right by it, and I'm so surprised that so many people have never seen it. Clearly, the people in government aren't aware of this. Even the senators, I mean, these senators should know this. They say they look at the Constitution. They should be looking at this. The U.S. Constitution, Article 5. The Congress shall propose amendments to this Constitution, which in either case shall be valid to all intents and purposes as part of this Constitution when ratified, provided, and this is the key, provided that no state without its consent shall be deprived of its equal suffrage in the Senate. Equal suffrage means vote. Their equal vote in the Senate. Each state has two votes, two senators. And no state shall be deprived of, without its consent, shall be deprived of its equal suffrage in the Senate. Now, senators, before the 17th Amendment, this is written in the Constitution and the way senators are to be chosen. In order for state to have equal suffrage, they have to have control of their senators. Our founding fathers created two houses. They created the Senate and the House of Representatives. The House of Representatives was to represent the people. No taxation without representation. Remember that? The House of Representatives represent the people. We have congressional districts. We send our congressmen into the Congress, into the House, to let our voices be heard. If we don't like this guy that we got in there, we vote him out. And this is where it's really important to get down to political process and not political BS. You know, they have all this politics. We want to get rid of the politics. We have a plan for that, too, after we get into the courts, how to get rid of the politics and move right into political processes. Just like we should be in court processes. But anyway, the states are to generally, as you know, there's a general rule of thumb, I would presume, I don't know. We see the way it was put together with Congress, we would presume it'd be the same way when individuals are voted in. A governor, for instance, which is like the president of the United States, the president of your state, okay, says, I'd like to send this person and this person in, I'd like them to be senators. And he sends them up to the two houses, and every state has two houses, okay? They have a Senate, and they have another representative, an assembly. Now, they send them into the two houses, and they vote on them. Both houses must approve these individuals. And once they're approved, you know, the president nominates them, the House approves them, and once that president signs the paper, they're in, okay? They now go into Washington representing the will of the legislature of their state and the governor of their state. They represent their will. They don't go in to make decisions on their own. They find out what's going on. They decide. They get involved with different things. They get the necessary education and whatever they're looking into. They need to bring it back to their house legislators, to their governors who need to discuss it, make the decision. We're going to vote this way, we're going to vote that way, and we're going to vote the other way. And that's the process. The states have been robbed of equal suffrage. They do not have a vote any longer. That was planned. It was an important part of the elite's plan to destroy our political process, to destroy our republic, to destroy the powers, the balance of power. Because it was easy to take political power through politics of the elected officials by the people. So if the people's representatives were hijacked, the Senate should have been there to protect it. If the House says go on with something and the Senate says, nah, we're not going for that, it doesn't pass. If the Senate says, yeah, we're going for that, and the House says, nah, we're not going for that, it doesn't pass. It's a balance of power, a requirement. It's key to the Constitution. And yet the 17th Amendment goes up against it. It's null and void. It's repugnant to the heart of the balance of power of our Constitution. Therefore, it doesn't exist. It's as if it never existed. Nullification is the rightful act. Jefferson spoke about that numerous times. Nullification is the rightful act. Ignore it. Pull your senators back. Fire them. Send your own. And just take control. That's what the states need to do. The 17th Amendment is null and void. It doesn't exist. It's irrelevant. It's repugnant. We don't want it. We're not going to accept it. States need to get together and do this. They need not go to do a constitutional amendment. They don't need to do anything but exercise their unalienable, well, not their unalienable right, but to a degree, their vested rights that we the people gave them. Clearly, the 17th Amendment deprives all states equal suffrage in the Senate. Thus, it is not a moot point. The Constitution is superior to any ordinary act of the legislature and must govern. Therefore, like the principle of the Kentucky Resolution, we're still on page 24, by the way, written by Thomas Jefferson, the founders of our republic which stated that simply by declaring their illegality, declare it to be illegal, that's all they got to do, announcing the strict constitutionalist theory of the federal government and declaring nullification to be the rightful remedy. That's all they got to do. Over. Just like we the people nullify in the court any law they bring up, they say, nah, we're not going to go along with that. We can nullify any law. Well, so can the states nullify anything that takes away a right from them. They could nullify that act. It's not a law. This is the whole of the 17th Amendment. This is the 17th Amendment can be nullified. I don't know what this is here. Got an error here. By the way, I was looking at this earlier. We do have a few errors in this. Anybody finds any errors, get a hold of Jan. You can find him on our directory. And just let him know what the error is, and he'll make note of it. And him and I will be going through this again the next few days. I found two or three errors. I got to go back through it with him. And anybody else that discovers any, get it to him, and we'll fix this. So please. Okay. The 17th Amendment can be nullified. There need not be an act of Congress. There need not be an amendment. Governors and state legislators need only declare, announce, and act. Let me repeat that. They only need to declare unconstitutional, show them why, nullify, and act. It doesn't get any more difficult than that. Let me see where it was. Declare, announce, and act by removing the unconstitutional senators and sending their own senators that will do the will of the state and restore the balance of power, because an unconstitutional act is not law. It confers no rights. It imposes no duties. It affords no protection. It creates no office. It is in legal contemplation as inoperative as though it had never been passed. That's Norton versus Shelby. No one is bound to obey an unconstitutional law, and no courts are bound to enforce it. American jurisprudence. It is quite a bit long thing. Well, you know, this is Marbury versus Madison gets into this. Anybody who hasn't read Marbury versus Madison, it's kind of short. You should read it. I think we have it posted up on our page of law. If not, we will be posting that. And also the Miranda versus Arizona. Where rights secured by the Constitution are involved, there can be no rulemaking by the legislation which would abrogate them. And, of course, Marbury versus Madison, the main thing is this theory is essentially attached to a written Constitution and is consequently to be considered by the court as one of the fundamental principles of a society. It is not, therefore, to be lost sight of for further considerations of this subject. If an act of legislation repugnant to the Constitution, it is void. Okay, and that's what Marbury versus Madison really gets involved with. And there's other things in there that are very powerful that we should know the things in those two cases particularly. The United States versus Williams, powerful, powerful paper, and of course these two papers. Okay. I'm going to read a little bit here about what our founder said. On page 26, our founders very much feared creating a government that had too many aspects of a pure democracy. They feared the destructiveness that a majority might have in trying to make everyone equal, and in the process taking away property rights, rights of property, and with it our basic freedoms, which they considered God-given freedoms. The fear had good basis. Our founding fathers were all knowledgeable people, and all knew and discussed how all prior democracies ended in disastrous failures. American history reached way back to the text of Judaism and Christianity, to the glory and failure of democracy in Athens, to Rome, and feudal times, and more. A democracy cannot exist as a permanent form of government. It can only exist until the voters discover that they can vote themselves benefits from the public treasury. From that moment on, the majority always votes for the candidate promising the most benefits from the public treasury, with the results of a democracy always collapse over loose fiscal policy, always followed by a dictatorship. The average age of the world's greatest civilizations has been 200 years. These nations have progressed through this sequence from bondage to spiritual faith, from spiritual faith to great courage, from courage to liberty, from liberty to abundance, from abundance to selfishness, from selfishness to apathy, from apathy to dependent, and dependent back into bondage again. Okay, there's a lot of good quotes here about democracy. So maybe I should read these, because these are pretty powerful, I think. At the 1787 Constitutional Convention, Edmund Randolph said that in tracing these evils to their origin, every man had found it in the turbulence and follies of democracies. It always goes back to democracies. If you want to create an oligarchy, if you want to take over a nation, first order of business is create a democracy. Then you can turn it into an oligarchy. In a pure democracy, there is nothing to check the inducement to sacrifice the weaker party or the obnoxious individual, James Madison. John Adams said, remember, democracy never lasts long. It soon wastes, exhausts, and murders itself. There was never a democracy yet that did not commit suicide. Chief Justice Marshall observed, between a balanced republic and a democracy, the difference is like that of between order and chaos. Thankfully, we do not live in a democracy. We live in a republic. How many people really know? I keep hearing this democracy. Even people I have respect for, I hear them talking about democracy. We're a democracy. That's how ignorant we are. We're not a democracy. America, U.S. Article 4, Section 4, the United States shall guarantee to every state in this union a republican form of government. That's a government under law, and in the case of our law being our Constitution, a Constitution that we, the people, ordained and established under that law, that is our republic. There are other republics out there created under constitutions that are made up by the politicians in order to entrap, to control. You know, I remember Scalia talking about the Russian Constitution. So they got a pretty good constitution, you know, but there's nothing there to enforce it, you know. They have freedom of religion. Well, we may not decide to give it to you. You know, it's a constitution made by the oligarchy itself, the dictators themselves. Okay. America is not a democracy. The word democracy is not found in any of our founding documents. Our founding fathers did not speak kindly of democracy. Democracy is the prelude to oligarchy. And upon that precipice, America stands today. And to those oligarchs hidden behind the administration, we, the people, are terrorists. And we intend on rooting them out, or routing them out. Okay, then we talk about the militia for the purpose of a free state. We talk about the Second Amendment, particularly focusing in on that militia necessary for the security of a free state, and we, the people, need to be armed. And then we write, we, the armed people of the United States of America, do not authorize a Homeland Security, which is an armed government, to protect these United States. We, the armed people of the United States of America, carefully and specifically ordained and established the militia, which is the unalienable right of we, the armed people of the United States of America, to protect the security of these United States, to execute the laws of the Union, to suppress insurrections, to repel invasions, as so ordered below. And we go through the U.S. Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 15, talking about the power of calling forth the militia. And in Article 1, Section 8.16, power to provide for the organizing, arming, and disciplining of the militia, and so on. And then also Article 2, Section 2, president being the commander-in-chief when called to be so, of also the militia. Now, again, you need to read through all this stuff very carefully and numerous times and look at footnotes and educate yourself, understand these things. Congress needs to get their head out of the proverbial hole in the sand and start obeying the law of the land. They need to start providing for the organizing, arming, and disciplining of the militia and shut down the unconstitutional Homeland Security that is militarizing our out-of-control federal agencies. This is the real threat to America. Congress needs to start establishing our armories and stock them for the defense of America, for the security of a free state. Congress can start by disarming all federal agencies and turning over all their weapons and ammunition to the armories. Congress needs to take back all militarized weapons that have been furnished to all law enforcement, including sheriffs, and turn them over to the armory. This is the weapons of we, the people. SWAT should be in the hands of the only constitutional law enforcement officer in America that can responsibly exercise proper discretion, the sheriff. There is a sheriff in every county. If the FBI or other law enforcement agency need a SWAT, they can call the sheriff. This militarizing of America must stop. It is a threat to our liberty, and clearly those who have such equipment are not responsible and mature enough to have such power, nor should they. Now, we do make a point concerning the FBI potentially having a SWAT team. I think that could be considered, but they need to get under the Constitution. It might be more appropriate, so to speak, for the U.S. Marshals to have it, but they're really, you know, control of the courts and focused in the courts, not so much in the transports of prisoners and that kind of stuff. And I do know that there are some offices, sheriff's offices are very small. Maybe they don't have enough people to create a SWAT team. They could always call the county in next door. But the law of the land. We, the people, did not, this is page 29 of 36. We, the people, did not authorize a constitution to be interpreted by bar lawyers who are unwittingly trained in the subversion of a constitution. For a line-by-line recollection and understanding of the Constitution, read the Federalist and Anti-Federalist papers. I don't think I read this, but earlier on is a place where Jefferson speaks about that. If you really want to understand what the Constitution is all about, don't try to stretch it and squeeze it and make it say what you want to make it. Take it for its word value. Go back to the time when it was created and to the decisions and the arguments that were taking place back then and understand its true intent. You do that by reading the Federalist Papers and the Anti-Federalist Papers. That's how you do that. There's plenty of history. There's quite a few books out there, The Making of America. There's Thomas Jefferson, the real Thomas Jefferson, the real George Washington, the real Benjamin Franklin. These are great books, and you discover who they are through their writings, back and forth to other people. That's how you discover who these people are, what their positions were, what they were thinking, what liberty truly is, their intentions. Let's see. We the people should not leave our liberty in the hands of those who seek to control us. As Jefferson said, if a people want to be ignorant and free, they expect what never was and never will be. It'll never happen. Let's see. This is Jefferson quotes, I believe. On every question of construction, carry ourselves back. Yeah, this is what I was just talking about. Carry ourselves back to the time when the Constitution was adopted. Recollect the spirit manifested in the debates, Federalist Papers, okay? And instead of trying what meaning may be squeezed out of the text or invented against it, conform to the probable one in which it was passed. We just have to become a little educated. The main difference between the common law courts our founding fathers provided and the courts that the bar has hijacked us into is the former are courts of justice and the latter are courts of law. Courts of justice always consider law as it is written in the hearts of men, remedy to the injured party, mercy and nullification, whereas courts of law are heartless, consisting only of the will of the legislator. It is not honorable to take a mere legal advantage when it happens to be contrary to justice. This is Thomas Jefferson. I don't want to... It's going on quite long, so I want to try to skip some more of this, skip a few more pages. Okay. Providing an education. Governments have not, will not, and cannot provide for a proper constitutional education for elected and appointed government servants and the people. Therefore, we the people formed National Liberty Alliance to provide that education. The purpose of NLA is to facilitate an education, communication, and provide for an assembly place for the people. Executive orders. And this is where it brings us to the key to what we really want to get to. Now, there's sort of a contradiction in here where we speak about the SWAT for the sheriff, and in here we talk about the SWAT for the FBI. We got to get in there and fix that contradiction. So we'll think about that and how we'll do that. But let me just read what we have here, okay? Providing an education, we spoke about that just a minute ago. Executive orders, okay, here it is. The president's executive orders can only be directed to cabinet members, federal agencies, armed forces, and militia when called in service. Congress cannot vest additional powers to the president that were not vested in him through the Constitution. The president does not have legislative powers. The purpose of the executive order is to ensure the president's will upon the agencies when necessary. The president has a sworn duty to govern under the law by the law. The remedy to lawlessness is the law. Crime is contagious. If the government becomes a lawbreaker, it breeds contempt for law. It invites every man to become a law unto himself. It invites anarchy. Olmsted versus the United States. We advise you, Mr. President-elect, to support the people by simply obeying the law and requiring your cabinet and all subservient agencies to do the same. You can solve the aforementioned grievances with the stroke of a pen by using your proper power of executive orders and the bully pulpit of the administration to lead our legislators and judicial branches to do the same. And then and only then will we, the people, enjoy the fruits of liberty again. The following proposed executive order or orders, with enforcement if necessary, will bring these government agencies back under the chains of the Constitution, and through We the People's Common Law Grand Jury, return government by consent of the people back to We the People, and then America will be great again. Proposed executive order, dated whatever date, directed to all department secretaries and subservient federal agencies, by virtue of the authority vested in me as President of the United States, it is ordered as follows. So this is what we propose, and he should be even more hardcore than we are. First of all, take notice, crime is contagious. If a government becomes a lawbreaker, it breeds contempt for law. It invites every man to become a law unto himself. It invites anarchy. Number one, it is the policy of this administration that all appointed government officials of the United States and all agency heads and all government employees are expected to have read and understand the Constitution for the United States, the Bill of Rights, and the Declaration of Independence in order to honor your oaths and obey the law of the land. Article 4, Clause 2 and 3, free constitutional and civil courses are available at NLA.org. This Constitution and the laws of the United States, it shall be made in pursuant thereof, and all the treaties made of which and shall be made under the authority of the United States shall be the supreme law of the land. Anything in the Constitution or the laws of any state to the contrary, notwithstanding. All executive and judicial officers, both the United States and of the several states, shall be bound by oath or affirmation to support this Constitution. Two. All federal servants are expected to know by what authority you act. Be advised, bar attorneys are unwittingly trained to subvert the Constitution. It is up to you to know. You took the oath. Laws are made of men for men of ordinary understanding and should therefore be construed by the ordinary rules of common sense. Their meaning is not to be sought out in metaphysical subtleties, which may make anything mean everything or nothing at pleasure. That was Thomas Jefferson. He also said common sense is the foundation of all authorities of the law themselves and of their construction. Number three, no military force is to be implemented against the people. Such an act would be high treason in violation of Posse Comitatus Act 18 U.S. Code Section 1385. Presidents cannot use executive orders to bypass the law of the land. Congress was vested with the power to legislate by the people. Presidents were not. Nor can Congress empower the president with legislative powers. Vested rights are not transferable. Only the people can ordain and establish powers and authorities. Therefore, executive orders cannot create power nor exercise powers not vested by the people. Four, if elected, appointed, or employed federal agents are exercising powers that were not empowered by the Constitution, they are acting under the color of law and subject to criminal prosecution. Sovereignty, of course, is not subject to law, for it is the author and source of law. But in our system, while sovereign powers are delegated to the agencies of government, sovereignty itself remains with the people by whom and for all government exists and acts, and the law is the definition and limitation of power. And that was Yick Woe versus Hopkins. Now, we read some of these earlier on, but this is to go into, the directive, the executive order. And again, this is what we're proposing. Therefore, the militarization of federal agencies is a tyrant's way of covertly transferring military power to federal agency by executive order to be used against the people in violation of Posse Comitatus. It was by these words, and this is what I was looking for before, it is by these words and his actions to militarize federal agencies that President Barack Obama committed acts of treason. We cannot continue to rely only on our military in order to achieve the national security objectives that we've set. We've got to have a civilian national security force that's just as powerful, just as strong, just as well-funded. President Barack Obama. I know we all remember those words. Six. militarized federal agencies, including the DHS, are not needed to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrection, and repel invasions because the Constitution already provides for those emergencies. Any substitution would be subversion. Now, we do over here speak the Article 1, Section 8, Clause 15, which we've read these, that's on providing for the militia and Posse Comitatus Act, which says whosoever accepts in case and under circumstances expressly authorized by the Constitution or acts of Congress willfully uses any part of the armed forces as a posse comitatus or otherwise to execute the law shall be fined not more than $10,000 or imprisoned not more than 2 years or both. I don't think that's enough. And by the way, we the people, if something like that were to happen, we can get rid of that, that's meaningless, that law, and make our own law because we call the law. We could do that in, as a jury. Number seven, no law enforcement federal agency is to be militarized and is ordered to dispose of all military equipment and ammunition by turning over said arms to the DOJ for redistribution to state armories. Number eight, all agencies except law enforcement agencies administered by the Department of Justice are to disarm and to dispose of all military equipment, ammunition, and small arms by turning it over said arms to the DOJ for redistribution to state armories. Number nine, all state enforcement is to be formed by agencies under Department of Justice. Number 10, with the exception of the FBI, no law enforcement federal agency, this is where we have a contradiction we have to fix, is to have SWAT teams. And in order to dispose of all SWAT equipment and ammunition by turning over said arm to the DOJ for redistribution to state armories. This next one here, well, there's one coming up. I'll let you know what it is. We should fix this problem, maybe. number 11, if any federal law enforcement agency needs a warrant executed with SWAT within any state, they are to contact the FBI for assistance. Number 12 may be the fix to this problem. Federal agents are to notify the county sheriff to lawfully execute federal warrants. 13, another part to fix this. If SWAT is necessary to execute a warrant, the sheriff is to oversee the federal agents. 14, government agents are not to violate the unalienable rights of the people. 15, government agents are not to approach the people in full military gear. 16, government agents are not to intimidate or threaten the people, nor detain the people without a lawful warrant. 17. Federal agents who are masked to hide their identity and to intimidate are committing acts of terror. 18. DHS is to cease all illegal wiretapping and spying on the American people. I think we have to put more on there, talk about these big computers being dismantled or something done with them. Okay, 19, this is the BOP, which is the Federal Bureau of Prisons, the BOP. BOP and U.S. Marshals, dieseling therapy is cruel and unusual punishment and a criminal offense. And anybody who doesn't know what dieseling is, you can go out to NLA on a docket page and look up dieseling therapy. You can find that on this page. Page 35 of 36. BOP and U.S. Marshals shackling prisoners to the floor for days so that they are unable to reach the toilet and thereby forced to lay in feces are committing cruel and unusual punishment, a criminal offense. BOP and U.S. Marshals putting prisoners in cold cells without blankets and pillows are also committing cruel and unusual punishment, a criminal offense. BOP U.S. Marshals, prisoner beatdowns are cruel and unusual punishments and a criminal offense. Formal investigations are required for all complaints. It is a criminal offense of conspiracy for any cover-up. 23. Solitary confinement for protective custody is cruel and unusual punishment and a criminal offense. 24. Political prisoners are to be released immediately. 25. BOP and U.S. Marshals secret prisons are to be shut down immediately. 26. IRS debitor prisoners are to be released immediately. 27 U.S. Marshals, in their federal capacity, are first and foremost constitutional law enforcement forces equivalent to the county sheriff and are to protect the rights of the people above all other duties. Marshals are appointed by presidents and cannot be unappointed or fired. Removed from office requires impeachment or indictment. 28. U.S. Marshals work for the justice system, the court, on behalf of the people, and not the judge or the prosecutor or the president. Attached, please find our redress of grievances in this court of record to our judiciary, legislator, and our governors, along with other supporting documents that can also be found at nationallibertyalliance.org/docket. By this action at law, we the people are officially reporting subversion within all branches of government against the United States by enemies both foreign and domestic, regardless of what extortion the powers that be will stoop themselves to maintain the status quo. We reject and stand on the principle and rely on God to control the outcome. Therefore, we the people will accept nothing but 100% total acknowledgement of the law of the land and obedience to the same. The greatest protection against these subverts is to reveal the light of truth and stand together. We must keep them so busy on offense that they cannot respond with covert defense, even when none pursueth them. In closing, we end with the words of the last president that tried to save our republic. Unfortunately, the people were not listening, and he stood alone on that fateful day. Today, we hear and we will reunite behind the president-elect, brave enough to lead us back to the promised land under the will of the king of our court, one nation under him. A revolution is coming. These are the words of JFK. A revolution is coming. A revolution which will be peaceful if we are wise enough, compassionate if we care enough, successful if we are fortunate enough. But a revolution which is coming, whether we will it or not, we can affect its character. We cannot alter its inevitability. That was quoted by JFK, and it was re-quoted by his brother Robert. The unified United States common law grand jury will be JFK's peaceful, wise, and compassionate effect upon the character of that inevitable revolution. We the people trust that we stand here today at that precipice with you, Mr. President-elect. Wherefore, you need not respond in writing, Mr. President-elect. We the people will expect your responses in words at your inauguration and through your actions in your first 100 days of office. After which, if necessary, we will reply with a show cause. Sealed and dated and signed by the foreman. Now again, that's kind of just the highlights. There's so much in here. People need to read this. Read it carefully. It's going to take you about an hour and a half maybe to read it, and you're going to want to read it more than once. And again, all of our papers should be read until you really understand and comprehend it. You know, we need not remember anything. Try not to remember anything. Only try to understand and comprehend. And what you understand and comprehend, you will not forget. It will fall out of your, off your lips. It'll just off your tongue. Okay, that brings us to the end of that. Let me see. I know we took quite a bit of time. I apologize for that, but it had to be done. Anything else before we move over to Brent? Gerard, do you have anything to say, Jan or Robert or anybody?
Not really.
Okay. Gerard, are you here? Calling Gerard. Is that Gerard? Did Gerard do that? I don't hear you, Gerard. Unmute yourself. Who did that? Was that Jan or Gerard? All right. Okay, so what we'll do is we'll move over to Brent. Brent, maybe if you can keep it kind of short tonight. We really ran out of a lot of time. We do want to get some questions, so... Maybe you can, you know, kind of comment on some of the stuff we're doing, and maybe during the week we should talk about some of these papers and get some advice from you. There's a few questions I had on the Constitution. Matter of fact, maybe I'll bring that up right now. One question particularly, and let me see. There was in Article 1, Section 8. Let me find it. Section 8, and let's see. It's not numbered here. I think it's 16, Clause 16 possibly. Okay. Yeah, it's 16. It says here, going back to Section 8, the beginning part, the Congress shall have the power to, and then we jump over to 16, provide for, one, organizing, two, arming, and three, disciplining the militia, and for governing such parts of them as may be employed in the service of the United States, reserving to the states, respectively, appointment of the officers and the authority of training the militia according to the discipline prescribed by Congress. But the key question I have here is on the arming part. I think I heard you said that the government isn't responsible for arming. And I would agree with you on the people's arming of the people, per se, with a weapon for its day and ammunition and so on. But I'm presuming that this means is to put the necessary weaponry, maybe some cannons or some kind of artillery or whatever is necessary, some tanks or some armored vehicles, in our armories. Or is that the state's requirement? And what is the federal's requirement on that? So hopefully you're here. I didn't even ask to see if he's here. Are you here, Brent?
I can give you a little bit of an answer on that, John.
Go right ahead, Robert.
At the time, yes, that was government did provide for that happening. However, in 1905, see, that was on the militias of the several states, and in 1905, the militias of the several states became the National Guard. And so now the militias, the president doesn't have any control whatsoever, nor Congress, over the militias.
Yeah, but, you know, when we get down to the National Guard, I'm a little ignorant here. Let me ask you questions. You may know the answer. The National Guard, is each state have its own National Guard controlled by the governor, generally speaking?
Yes, every state has their own National Guard, and they can be called up by either the president or the governor, and they both have the same authority over them. Whoever calls them up first rules.
But okay, now we get to another situation. Yep. Good.
I was just going to say that's the way it was with the militias of the several states back before that, before 1905.
Okay, so this would be considered now the organized militia, the National Guard, is what you're saying. We should call them the organized militia, though. We need to change that name properly to a constitutional name as the organized militia and not the National Guard, because that gives a false understanding of what it is. They're not here to guard the nation. They're here to guard their sovereign state. And I remember there was a situation in history, and I'm trying to remember, maybe someone knows which where this was, but the national the militia of a particular state was called to order to defend, and then they were ordered out to assault, you know, outside of the boundaries of their state. The people who were in the militia back then literally said, no, we're not going. We're here for the purpose of protecting the state, and we're going to stay here to protect the state. You need someone to go outside to go pull the army together and do what you got to do, but that's what our job. You can't take us out of our state and leave this state defenseless. And that made all the sense in the world.
I suspect that's why the change was made to National Guard from the
that's
militia
why
in
we
the several states.
That
and right. there's some confusing information because not when they made that change in 1905, they didn't change the wording in a lot of the Constitution where it talked about the militias of the several states. And so there's still quite a bit of confusion there.
Yeah, this has got to be fixed. We have to approach Congress when we can finally get some clout to fix this problem and bring back the proper names for this, the militia, and understanding of what they're for. Now, I would imagine if there was a rebellion or insurrection somewhere in a particular state, that the president would call for the militia of the state involved. Now,
right.
For another state to enter in to assist that state, you know, they could, if they felt it necessary to go and help defend because it's a losing battle, by all means they can go. If that state requests, you know, if you're in New York and they request Jersey help in New York, then Jersey would come help. They
yes.
would have, you know, I would think that yes. they wouldn't resist that kind of thinking. But
no.
Because we're here to protect the nation, but for the president to call up the militia and pull people from different states to go deal with a problem in another state, I don't think would be proper. And that's my thinking. I don't have enough knowledge here, but that seems logical to me.
Well, what I object to is how the president can call up the National Guard and send them to a foreign country.
Exactly. He doesn't. That's a major problem.
Yes.
So, we got to fix this problem. We can't fix it now, but when we get control, we can fix it. We will fix it. So.
Yep.
All right. Anything else you want to comment on that?
No, I just that's something that you know I really want to see the stuff on the militias fixed. I mean, yes, the mm-hmm. militias of the several states is no longer. It's actually the National Guard. So the, you know, the history needs to be written properly, or the changes. I'm not sure that it was properly initiated. I don't, you know, the Constitution wasn't, I don't think it
right.
was
properly
done.
Right, I know Brent's talked about that. Yeah, Brent talked about that the Dick Act and another one, that these were a problem. And I got them both. There are two or three acts. I got to read through them and go through them to see and try to figure out what might be constitutional and what might not is not. But anyway, my thoughts were what I had said. All right,
well,
let me move over to...
1905 is when they made a lot of changes in a lot of different areas, and I think that's... I think a lot of it is where they started taking things away from us.
What was the earliest, do you know, that was the Militia Act? What year was the earliest? I suppose in the early 1800s, no?
Well, yeah. When they,
I got to go back and read them. So.
Yeah, when the people, you know, they started having problems with the British when they knew they were going to have to, you know, protect themselves from Britain. That's when the people
okay.
became the militia.
Right. All right, I appreciate
training.
That. I see that Brent is in the Q&A. Jan, can you find Brent in the room and unblock him, unmute him? But before we let him take over, I want to just ask, take on the first question. We got someone in there. We only got one person other than Brent in the Q&A right now. Q&A, star 6 to get in there.
Well, Brent's
first
unmuted.
Caller, let me just take this first caller before we turn it over to you, Brent.
Okay.
Let's see, it's Dr. Fred from California. I think you were trying to call me, so go ahead, Dr. Fred.
Hey, good evening, John. It's so good to hear your voice. I've been on for a long while, and wish you the happiest of Thanksgiving and ready for the Christmas season. Listen, I have just a request, brief request. We're still in the battle. My son is one of the guys in a terrorist prison, unlawful prison in Marion, Illinois, still working on his habeas, still working. I need someone to help me if they've got PACER. I sent Jan a email, and if you know anyone that's got access to PACER that can help me get some Ninth Circuit and World Court documents, I desperately need it for our filings. So just a request. I sent all my information to Jan in an email. If someone out there can help that has a PACER account, my numbers are listed, my email is listed, and I could greatly use it. It's a timely thing. We're trying to get it done by 15th of December.
All right, I'll see what we can do.
Okay.
Meanwhile, were you here early enough to when we started? Did you hear?
I was here. I was there 10 minutes. I was there 10 minutes prior to you getting there. So.
Okay. Good.
Yeah.
All right, because I mentioned we're going to be resurrecting all of the habeas corpuses we did and bring them into this court case and bring show cause orders against all these people, and where we can get. Where we can get affidavits. Anybody who has a habeas corpus and can get an affidavit to state the fact that, A, we have in one case this happening right now where the affidavit is being made, to state that, A, the clerk, instead of filing it, took it to the judge, who we had sent a copy to anyway, and the judge, this particular judge, sent it off and put a note on it, sending it off to the lawyer of the defendant and requiring that he discharge or do something with it. I don't know what he was requiring. So therefore, the judge participated in the conspiracy of removing the papers. And then when this lawyer got it, he knows the law, he became a third party of the conspiracy. And those three individuals have to answer now on criminal charges that we're going to bring up against them by what authority they think they had to be able to remove or prevent or destroy or discard any papers that were properly filed. And
but one person that comments on the circle jerk, which I call it, where they run you through the ringer and then after you get out they run you again, there's only one person in maybe 10,000 of the in the judiciary that know to do that, John. And unfortunately, it's not enough people right now. We got to, hopefully, and I'm prayerfully praying that this new president will bring in a new room, a new sweep. He's the first president that we've had that's not been a non-political since Eisenhower. Many of your listeners don't even know who Eisenhower was, let alone he was a president. But the bottom line is we got to get to that place where Eisenhower's whole thing was a new broom sweeps clean. And that's what this man is saying. He's talking about the technology being cleaning the swamp. But that's what we need to do. And it needs to be revamped. If it's not revamped, we're fighting. We're a wet noodle going uphill. It just will never get done. And I'm not negative, and you know that. But I'm discouraged. My son is in his 12th year, still fighting. Never, no victim and no violence. And still fighting with an indictment that was flawed right from the outset. You know, if they could do it to him.
We are trying to get to that mass, and we've got quite a few membership now. You know, we're just about 6,000. And we have lots of people. We have name recognition, a lot of people paying attention. What we're doing now with this potential access into the president's office, so to speak, to the president's administration, sort of through an individual, and they say they're interested in our paperwork. They've read some of them. They want more, and this is what we're going to be sharing with them shortly. Hopefully in the next week or so, we'll have it all done and send the whole pile over to them. We're also going to require them to respond in the court. We're going to take them in as a court, as a defendant in the court for redress of grievances, but. If we can get the Liberty groups to become aware of what we're doing and to take a look and become educated, they don't need to stop whatever they're doing. They can continue everything they're doing, but come here for an education. Stand up with the people in the courts. Let's get this thing done. Let's stand behind the president. Let's put these people on the offensive.
let's remember the word also that if any man lack wisdom, let him ask of God, that giveth to all men liberally and upbraideth not. And if Sessions gets in there as the attorney general, and we get some people there that have spine and backbone and can answer to a president who wants to clean sweep, then we'll see. This is the year of Jubilee. If it was going to happen in any year, it's going to happen this year. And every day this year, I put my foot on the ground, I remember that this is the year of Jubilee, where we take everything back to zero. It's the 50th year. And let's see if God is not in it. 2 Chronicles 7:14, if my people, the Constitution says, we the people, the Scripture said, God says, if my people, and if my people will, God said, I will heal your land. If my people won't, God's not going to hurt your land. It's already hurt. He's just going to take his hand off of it. So it's a simple narrative.
We the people, generally speaking, are his people from the standpoint of those who understand and appreciate that we do indeed have a covenant with God. And
exactly.
We made that covenant with God in 1776 with the Declaration of Independence.
Sure.
And every document thereafter to the Bill of Rights, the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, which secured that agreement with God. No man can break it. These men have been trying to break it. The wrath of God is going to come down upon these people.
Sure,
in 2017, there is a great, great significance on 2017, which this is not a good place for me to talk about it, but there is a great significance on that. And we have entered into what is called the Jubilee of Jubilees, which is a 50-year period, which started, the Jubilee of Jubilees actually started in September 6, 1994. And it goes on for 50 consecutive years of the Jubilee of Jubilees. And we're entering into that third judgment, which is coming upon the nations, okay? And then, of course, at some time after that, I don't know when, it'll be the final judgment day where every man stands up for his own, unless Christ has already done that for him. But, I think this is the year. We have a president in there that looks like he might be with us. He's in big, big trouble just trying to do what he says he's going to do. He needs the people behind him.
Yes,
and if he gets behind us, we can rally all of the liberty groups. And once the liberty groups understand that there is a communion, a little bit of a communion between us and him, and that his response is to really bring back the control of the Constitution to require these people under the change of the Constitution on the federal level, which he could do with the stroke of a pen, and get rid of anybody who breaks that command. That man, that person needs to be indicted. Send them to us and we'll indict them if they do not listen to the command of the president. All he has to do is send them to us. We'll deal with them. We'll indict them, and he'll help us to get the enforcement. But we're going to use our court case for the enforcement. The enforcement basically we don't need these people to be arrested. We need them to come and stand in the court before a trial jury that we will bring together in a court of law in the federal courts for constitutional issues. And we'll do it, according to the rules of the federal court. And at the end of the day, that trial jury is going to make a decision. And if jail isn't part of that process, those people will be apprehended and placed in prison if that's the necessity. So we will get it, and it's going to happen. And I think we can really start to rally around that. All right, let me move over to appreciate your time.
Merry Christmas, John, and God bless you. You're in our prayers every day, and we stand shoulder to shoulder. We come alongside like the paraclete to bless you and to minister to you in any way, shape, or form. God bless you.
Appreciate that. Thank you. Get that information concerning the docket number or any information we need to Jan. And
I got it to her already. I sent it off tonight.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
God bless you, John.
Let me move. Thank you. You too. Let me move to the next caller. Brent, are you there?
I'm here.
Okay. I'm going to kick you out of the question area. Let me make sure you don't get muted. Okay, you're still unmuted. Talk to me.
Let me hit
the next question. Okay, you got unmute. You got muted. Okay, now try. See if you're there.
Yeah, I'm here, John.
Okay, I can hear you now.
Okay.
What are you calling in off the wrong phone or something?
No, I don't. I've called the number I've always called, but it wouldn't come in. I've hung up, tried again, and it's so. Well, maybe we can get this sorted out later. But yeah, it's always the number I've always called, same phone. I don't know what's the matter.
Okay. Yeah, because the number had changed. If you go up to the Monday night call, click on a Monday or weekly call
I
on
will.
The website.
That's that. Okay.
And
I
then
gotcha.
You'll
I
see the new number there. Okay.
Okay.
The,
gotcha.
The new dial-in number, well, you'll have to talk. I'll tell you what, Jan, maybe you can send him the
I can
the
send
new
it
dial-in
to him
number that he needs.
Right,
okay,
I'll get it
he's
to
not
going to
come in. Yeah, he's going to come
thanks.
In as a host. So
I appreciate it.
Okay, let me pass things over to you, and
okay.
We're in the queue for questions and answers. I don't know if you... If you were listening, maybe you might want to respond to some of the things we were talking about when we were looking for you, and something about also with the armory and what we'd like them to do with the all of this military equipment. Get your thoughts on that, and whatever you heard.
Okay, but can somebody tell me just real quick before I start the name of Fred's son?
Remember the names of their sons, huh?
Well, maybe somebody can email that to me later. Somebody,
all
if
right.
somebody knows, they can email it to me. And if anybody knows, maybe right. Fred's listening, he can go to commonlawyer.com and email that.
Yeah, well, Fred, get back into the queue. No one's in there right now, Fred. Get back into the queue, and we'll unmute you, and you can give Brent the name of your son. I don't remember. Was it Chris, maybe? All right. If he's here, he'll get back in the queue.
Okay.
Go ahead, Brent.
All right. Thanks. Appreciate it. And... begin.
Oh, before you go, Gerard, are you still here? Did you come back?
I'm back. I had to reboot. I'm here. Can you hear me?
Okay, I'm going to pass things to you. Brent is taking, he's going to talk a little bit. I'd like him to try to focus, if he can, on what we've been talking about, and then he could pick up on other things next week, and then we'll take questions, Q&A. I'll give you the controls. I might disappear. I'm exhausted, and I might disappear a little while. But
I have one thing. I'll wait till Brent is done, though. I had somebody send me something on committees of safety, and I'd like to comment on that shortly tonight. But I'll wait until Brent is finished. Okay.
Okay. Thanks, Gerard.
Yeah. Well, appreciate it. And the things I say may or may not be the views of National Liberty Alliance. We must be careful to emphasize that. Although probably most of what I say will be, from what I can gather. We were talking, or somebody mentioned a while ago.
And
no,
by the way,
yeah, go ahead.
Do find differences. By the way, Brent, whenever we do find differences, we should try to find time during the week to talk to see if we can't convince the other to see which is the correct position to have.
That'd be helpful. I appreciate it.
Yeah, you have a lot more knowledge on. Okay, this militia stuff, I'm very not knowledgeable much at all, but go ahead.
Well, and I'm always learning. I'm still learning, reading about it, and... I'll hope to get to that in a minute. I want to get to the thing that was mentioned first, which was the question about the pardon of the president. Now, the foundation of our pardon in modern times at common law, it hasn't changed, of course, since our country started. That's why it was inserted into our Constitution. Its fundamentals can be found in the fourth volume of Blackstone's Commentaries on the Laws of England. The fourth volume, and toward the end of that volume, I forget exactly where it is, but he goes into great detail there discussing the pardon and what it is and why it is, etc. But he doesn't go into the history of it much. The pardon is a creature of our common law, and it is a softening of the potential harshness of the criminal element, the criminal convictions, and government getting out of hand, because it is axiomatic that people are convicted of things they never, the crimes they never did, crimes of which they are not guilty. It goes on all the time. I know when George Bush, the second, the younger one, the boy, when he left office, he pardoned hundreds of people. And one of the fellows he pardoned was a fella not too far from me in my neck of the woods, and he was a notorious coon hunter that had worked for the railroad. Well, he got laid off from the railroad and was collecting unemployment. Well, he was moonlight, doing some kind of thing, making a little money on the side, and he never He never told them when he applied for his federal benefits, unemployment as a railroader. And they convicted him and made a felon out of him. Well, that means he couldn't go coon hunting anymore with a gun. So he got into the process. It was a 5-year process. The way I remember it, you have to wait 5 years till after your sentence is completely over. And then you start a long, arduous process of staying in touch with a commission in Washington, D.C. that handles presidential pardons. And when that's all done, if you're fortunate, the president may pardon you. For whatever reason, the president of the United States pardoned this obscure coon hunter who didn't have any political connections at all. Of course, the president at that time pardoned a lot of people that were not obscure, too. But he did it for whatever reason. It is an arbitrary thing that presidents do, and most all of them do it, and do it with a vengeance. And they do it in ways that, well, they pardon people that people wouldn't approve of them pardoning. That's why they wait till the end of their term, and they know they won't be president anymore. That's what they do. But the pardon arises, most interestingly to me, it arises, and this is behind what Blackstone says. Blackstone was lecturing. What he says in his commentaries, he lectured in the year 1765, about 11 years before our country started, and they put it in writing. So that's pardon, as you read there, as it stood at that time. But pardon arises out of that doctrine, that doctrine we're familiar with from watching Western movies. Those of us who grew up watching Western movies, we knew what outlaws were. Outlawry. Outlaws, those are the fellows that anybody could bring in, alive or dead or alive. Didn't make any difference because they were outlaws. What did that mean? That means that the law had declared them outside its protection.
Start gun control? Well, that's terrific.
And because that man was outside the protection of the law, anybody that wanted to could bring him in, bring his carcass in, or bring his live body in. Didn't make any difference. Because that's a common law doctrine, by the way. And anciently, at common law, outlaws were people outside the law. And let me read what Maitland and Pollock says. Maitland and Pollock, probably nobody knew more about the history of the common law and the laws of England than Frederick Pollock and Frederick Maitland. Wrote a ton of books back in about the year 1900. But they say this: outlawry is the sentence of death pronounced by a community which has no police or professional hangman. That's a professional executioner. Outlawry is the sentence of death pronounced by a community which has no police or professional executioners. And they continue, to pursue the outlaw and knock him on the head as though he were a wild beast is the right and duty of every law-abiding man. To knock him on the head as though he were a wild beast was the right and duty of every law-abiding man. You have to ask yourself, and people sometimes do, why would he say right and duty? Why wouldn't he just say duty? Because if it's a duty, it's not an option. Well, the reason is because he's using that word right in its real meaning, and we have forgotten its real meaning. Its real meaning is jurisdiction. Your rights are your jurisdiction, and they include the duty that you have to perform within that jurisdiction, the discretion you have to exercise. Well, that's what he's saying here. To pursue the outlaw and knock him on the head as though he were a wild beast is the jurisdiction and the duty. It's something you have to do of every law-abiding man. Well, this ancient teaching called outlawry came to the forefront when Winston Churchill called for it right after World War II. They didn't capture all the Nazis that they said were criminals, and so Churchill said, well, what we ought to do is just get a declaration of outlawry against them, and then people can hunt them down and kill them, and that'll be the end of that. But other people that had influence in the matter did not prevail, and they were not declared outlaws. But at common law in Anglo-Saxon England, Anglo-Dane England, before the arrival of the highly Romanized Normans that lived on the coast of France, an outlaw was called a wool for fod. Wilferfod, and that means, in old Anglo speech, one bearing upon his neck the head of a wolf. One bearing upon his neck the head of a wolf, therefore, anybody that had that would find him had a duty to slay. He's nothing but a wolf. That's what the Declaration of Outlawry said. But most important about outlawry, and I'm talking about pardon, I'm getting to that, and what pardon is at common law, its roots. The only way that a person could escape outlawry, once it was decreed, and the common law was only decreed by the jury of the community, once it was decreed, the only way you could escape it was by the pardon of the king. The pardon of the king at his discretion. And if he decided to do that, when you came back, you were dead because outlawry declared you dead. Remember, Maitland had it right up here. He said outlawry is the sentence of death. Death. You're as good as dead. You're an animal. You're declared an animal, and you're as good as dead. And even if no one finds you and kills you, you're not a man anymore. So pardon, if a king decided to pardon one outlawed, he entered the world again as a newborn babe. That means all of the benefits he may have had, all of the debts, all of the burdens, all of the blessings. He may have been part of the nobility. He may have had a degree from a major university. He may have had awards and benefits, and he also had obligations of contract, and who knows what he had. Well, when he came back from outlawry, he didn't have any of those things. He came into the world naked like a baby with nothing but a complete pardon. And that was the nature of outlawry. And by the way, it was fashioned wholly upon the writings of John the Apostle in the Bible when he said, you must be born again. And that outlawry was a picture of the Christian faith. And that's why it was used in England. Because you were declared a dead man in your sins. What is sin? Transgression of the law. It's an old English word, means transgression of the law, worthy of death, judged already, and the only way out is pardon. And that, by the way, is the picture of the new birth. God pardons. In his discretion, he pardons a man, and he enters the world, and that's why Paul the Apostle said, and he had several university equivalent degrees. He had all the benefits of Babylonian Judaism to the hilt. They could do anything they want, steal, kill, destroy, and get away with it, like those holding the levers of power now do in Washington, D.C., we're discovering through WikiLeaks. They do anything they want. Paul said, I was one of those guys. He said, I was one of those guys. And he said, but I count all of that as human excrement. It's worthless to me because I was born anew, and all of the benefits I had, all of the burdens, all of the contracts, I'm a new person, a new creature. I don't have that anymore. Well, that's what pardon is. And presidents that use that, the question comes, if they do use it, and this was raised a while ago, should they pay for their crimes if they're pardoned? Well, in light of this ancient doctrine, and its fundamentals have never changed, I'll leave that up to your consideration. If you want to read more about outlawry, it's section 410 of my comparative law text called Excellence of the Common Law. And there are other things in there in the book about it, but I focus on it there, on outlawry and pardon, and the basis of common law pardon. The other thing that came up was the militia of the several states and the federal involvement, the general government, as our forebears called it. They didn't call it the federal government. They called it the general government. The reason they called it the general government, because its laws, the laws that Congress passed, the Constitution, were an overarching authority, jurisdiction, that took in all the states, and where federal law speaks, if it's constitutional, it occupies the field. It occupies that particular thing to which it speaks. And when our Constitution says, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 16, that the Congress has the power to provide for the organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia, and for governing such parts of them that may be employed in the service of the United States, and reserving to the states, respectively, the appointment of the officers and authority of training of the militia according to the discipline prescribed by Congress. What a fellow has to do here, and this is what the Supreme Court does with the Constitution persistently. They just take the language, and that's a long sentence, by the way, and that's not even a full sentence. That's a long sentence, and the clause 16 is just part of a sentence. What they do is they diagram the sentence, and the reason they do that is because that's the foundation, the language that they have to interpret. They hark back to it, because no matter what else the court may have said about it, the courts may provide guidance and help along, but if the courts are not true to the text of the Constitution, then we must adjust ourselves and go back. They're very careful here. These commas and these participles. Let me just say this about it, and I'll let you, if you remember your bonehead grammar from the eighth grade, you can go back and try to parse it yourself, try to diagram the sentence. But it says Congress has the power to provide for the organizing, arming, and disciplining of the militia. Who are the militia? They're the people. This is the people. They have the power to provide organizing, arming, and discipline, and for governing, watch this, such part of them as may be employed in the service of the United States. What's the point? The point is this. When the President of the United States calls out the militia of the several states or any part of them, at that point, once they've answered, the individuals answered that call and mustered, at that point, the general government in Washington, D.C. has the power to provide for the arming and the disciplining of that militia, and not before. What does that mean? That means the federal government does not have the power to provide whatever they call the National Guard, the militia of the states, with equipment and arms. That's what that means. That's what it says. Now, I've got two choices. I can go along with the Dick Act, Senator Dick, his ideas, what he thought was expedient, and what he thought would really work, regardless of what the Constitution says, or I can go with this. This is the supreme law of the land. This is how the supreme law of the land is due process. It stresses how a thing is to be done. How is this to be done? If the governor calls out the militia, and traditionally the militias of the several states, each one of them traditionally, and that's our law, common law informs here, this is the common law. Every man provided his own weapon at his own expense and his own training, and the kind of weapon the state legislature would demand, the category, the number of rounds, and that's what the Militia Act, the year 1792, of Congress, promoted that idea of what a man was supposed to provide for himself, the training, the marksmanship training, the safety training, the weapon itself, and it would go a long way to our freedoms if men were just simply armed personally with a military-grade weapon. These folk that are Go ahead, I'm sorry. I heard somebody say something.
Yeah, just let me ask you a question. So what you're saying then is that it's the state's requirement or duty to make sure that certain weaponry is in the armory. I mean, let's look like, you know, maybe some artillery, some armored vehicles, maybe a tank. You know, certain things that would be necessary as far as heavy equipment is concerned, that should be supplied by the state, you're saying, to the armories?
No, I didn't say that, but that's better.
No, I'm just asking. Because I don't know the answer.
Yeah, you're making a good point, though. And what our Constitution stresses is that the federal government doesn't have the power to fill up the armories of whatever they call the militia of the states. They call it the National Guard. And we must keep in mind, as somebody said a while ago, the National Guard is constitutionally unknown. There is no such thing. It should be scuttled,
right?
Because the National Guard is nothing but the feds trying to control the whole situation. And that goes against the fundamentals of why we have the militia of the several states. So, yeah, the federal government has the power to provide arms and equipment and ammunition once they're mustered in the federal service, but not before. And I would go ahead.
Let me ask you another question on that, though.
Yes.
If they have to provide it at that point, now let's say an emergency erupts and they need to muster individuals, and the individuals are going to need some heavy equipment. Well, if they haven't been trained on that heavy equipment, there's no one qualified. So again, it gets back to the armories and training of the militia, and I would think the organized militia. Again, you know, we need to think about what exactly that is, and are they spending? Do they go in for a term of so many years, or they go in for so many weeks or months or days a year, or how does that work? You know, I don't know what the you know, as far as when there's no concern of war, but they have to be trained and they have to be ready.
No, that's true, and you make excellent points. And the truth is, throughout our history, this has never been fleshed out sufficiently. Different things have been tried, and that's what Justice Story, and so you're bringing up, how is this really going to work? How are we going to make this thing stand up and walk? You're talking about the details of how it has to work, and those things haven't been answered. Justice Story said that. He said, my great fear is that these clauses will be ignored. And if they're ignored, then they'll be forgotten, and this great palladium, he calls it, the badge of our freedom will be taken away, or we'll forfeit it, and that's what we've done. And so the things you're talking about in the Dick Act was a foolish attempt to try to remedy the problems that you're addressing very well. Now, there are lines drawn. What we need to do, in my humble opinion, is say, what are the fundamentals here? Let's don't violate the fundamentals. The fundamentals are that the feds are not provide the weapons and the equipment, because once they do that, then they're in control, and the states have no control, and that's contrary to the fundamentals. Then, but you're raising questions that are important, too. Well, then how do we make this work? Well, as I'd said before, I'm not, from my perspective, I'm not worried about the equipment. If men have arms, they just have personal arms, that's going to go most of the way for the militia to do what it's intended to do according to God's word and according to our common law. We see what the militia is supposed to do. Keep the government at bay.
Have you ever been in an armory that's fully equipped at some point in your life? I mean, I remember armories when I was a kid, and you know, today these armories are all closed. Armories are all closed down. But when I was a kid, I was never inside them. Now, I've been inside some of them that have been stripped down. There's nothing in them. They're using them for other reasons. And I've been inside those armories, but. You know, the equipment that should be in there. Have you ever seen the equipment in there, and what kind of equipment?
I've served in armories. Yeah, I know what the ones I was served in.
So did they have armored vehicles? Did they have tanks? Did they have any things of that nature? Artillery?
Yes.
And who supplied that? The state had supplied that?
No, the feds. The feds supplied those things, and the feds then even supply. You know, they go. The men go to. I did go to boot camp. It was Army armory. I didn't go to boot camp with the Army, but the boys that would join up, they'd send them to federal boot camp at federal expense. There's a federal funding that goes on there, and that's the great danger. And we all know, once the feds provide the money, they, just like our education system, they control everything. Either do what we say or we'll pull the funding. There's something about governments that are too weak, and they will do anything the federal government tells them to, right down to saying we're going to let boys and girls use the same bathrooms. That's what goes on. Of course, that's what I think needs to be avoided in this. Now, there is a model in the back of my militia book, a model state militia statute. And you might look at that, and I imagine you would, and say, well, I see problems here. Well, that's okay. We got to start someplace addressing the problem. But I say, that, again, the first thing that we must do is make sure that men are armed. Men are armed, and they're required to be armed. That starts at the state legislature level. That by the time you're 20 years old, you have to have this kind of weapon, and you have to obtain this kind of training. And we're not going to do it today because I want to give Gerard enough time to say what time we got here, what he wants to. We'll probably quit in just a little bit. But we'll get into the benefits of the militia and the importance of that ongoing idea of young men having a rite of passage into manhood. If there's anything missing in America right now, it's the confidence of young men having a purpose and a stake in their own community, And one way to do that is not to say you got to go register for the draft. No, that's not bad. It's not even constitutional in many people's minds, never has been. But the one thing they would need to do is go down and say, I'm a member of the militia now, and I have to get a weapon. I have to procure a weapon somehow. I have to get a job. I got to do something, or I'm going to be fine. That's what we need, and that's what young men need, and it also provides a link between the older generation, a commonness, and the younger generation. And it will create a cohesiveness among us that we need, and we're lacking manhood, we're lacking maleness, we're lacking cohesiveness, we're lacking a commonness of experience. And the commonness of experience that God wants us to have is jury duty and armed defense. Jury duty and armed defense. That'll pull us together.
Well, it seems that we need something written down, a plan that makes common sense that we need to rally around and push our representatives to do, because they have to do something, and it has to be constitutional, and we have to require it. And is that something you think we could do that would be a minimum? I mean, how many pages of information would we have to list out in order to and make the points of what the government is required to do in order to, suffice the Constitution? You know, I think one of the big problems, you're talking about money that goes to the federal government and then they give it back to us. Of course, all that's illegal. And I think one of the major problems that caused that and allowed them to do that is the 17th Amendment. I think once the states lost their right of a vote in the Senate, then they lost a lot of things. And once, of course, the political machine picked up the control of the Senate, as it had already of the House of Representatives, all was lost. And I think that's a major way to get around it. If the states don't have to send all this money to the federal government, they'd be able to keep it within the state and do what they need to do with it.
Yes, you know? I agree. Yeah, and it's just nothing but a slush fund. That's all it is. And if we turned around, instead of giving 25% to the feds, give 25% to the local state and 3% to the feds. I'm not saying we should give that much at all, but if we had to give 25% to state government, it wouldn't last very long, because we can get our hands on the state legislators and we can throttle them and say, this isn't going to happen. We can't do that with a congressman. They're wholly other. They're too separated. Matter of fact, they don't represent us at all. The reason they don't represent us at all is because every congressman represents 700,000 people. Well, I say represents. He can't represent 700,000 people. Our forefathers said any time representation gets beyond 30,000, there can't be any representation. I think they were right. Well, we're so far beyond that now, it's beyond comprehension. And we have limited, since a long time ago, limited the number of people we can have in Congress. You know, we started out with just a few, and then we kept adding as our population grew. And now we've capped it at 535. And, well, 435. And I wonder about that, but it's a serious problem. Representative government isn't available to us at the federal, at the general government level.
Is there a feasible answer to these problems? Is there something that appears?
Yes, there is, and you've been talking about it. And above all things, the foundation is the jury. The jury is the court of last resort in America. And you were talking about this a while ago, the jury has the power to annul the law. And if the jury doesn't have the power to annul the law, then there is no check at all upon the power of Congress to legislate any crazy thing that you want. A while ago you said, you were quoting somebody, said there were 4,500 federal criminal laws. Well, the last count I had, and the last count I had are 5,550. And that was according to a study done by a former Supreme Court justice and another committee back in 1998. So I imagine it's up around 6,000 now or better. And as you pointed out, they have no jurisdiction. They only have jurisdiction for four kinds of crimes: counterfeiting, the current coin and securities of the United States, piracies and felonies committed on the high seas. There's two. Three, violations of international law. And number four, treason. Treason, violation of international law, piracies and felonies committed on the high seas, and counterfeiting the current coin and securities of the United States. And if the criminal legislation Congress passes doesn't address those four, then it's unconstitutional, ipso facto, because if there's anything fundamental to our American way of government, it is that the general government in Washington, D.C. is a limited government, and the courts have limited jurisdiction at the federal level, and the state governments, by comparison, are governments and courts of unlimited jurisdiction. Now, I realize I'm speaking in the sense of life here on earth. They're not God. God has ultimate unlimited jurisdiction. But, and that's what our Declaration of 76 says, the supreme judge of all the world. But among men, the state governments, and lawyers are taught this, it's on their bar exams, they have to learn it. Federal courts are courts of limited jurisdiction according to the Constitution. State courts are courts of unlimited jurisdiction. You know, a state court can hear anything a federal court can hear, plus everything else, things that aren't even listed. If there's a wrong done, there must be a remedy, somebody said a while ago. All these good things coming up, the talk is, to get these ideas back in our head is powerful. But where there's a wrong, there has to be a remedy, and if there isn't a remedy that the law has listed, well, then it's up to the courts at common law to fashion a remedy. That's the beauty. That's what sets us apart from the world. If your silly problem, we used to say in the military, if your silly problem doesn't fit in the Uniform Code of Military Justice, nobody's listening. Nobody's going to hear it. That's true all over the world. Under the code of Justinian, if your problem doesn't fit into the code, it doesn't exist. Well, in America, we can go into court and say, I got a problem. I just got robbed. I lost my life, my liberty, my property, or some part thereof, and I want some redress. We can petition government. And we need to be doing that, of course. Well, I'll off the subject a little bit, but this thing about the militia, again, the militia booklet's about 100 pages long, and the last thing I have in the militia booklet, the militia of the several states, our answer to our enemies, the Constitution's answer to its enemies, foreign and domestic, and in the last thing I have in there is a model militia statute. And I didn't copy any other statute. I'd read a lot of things, but I just sat down, and I started working through it just like you were kind of doing a while ago and say, well, here's a problem. How can I solve this problem? And I'd come up with an idea, and then I'd try to make sure it was all consistent, didn't contradict itself. It's something to look at and begin thinking. It's
so
a
that,
model.
So that thing. Book that book is could be considered a feasible answer and a solution to the problem we're talking about.
It starts us into that direction, yes. I don't think I have all the answers, but I think those booklets would maybe good in the hands of a state legislator who might be interested. And that model state militia statute at the end, he could turn it over to the committee there that's hired to draft statutes. Most state legislatures hire people that are nonpartisan, that the legislators will tell them what they want, and they'll draft the statute. They'll do that, and then he offers it to the legislature. He can read it, work with them a little if he wants. This booklet might give them a start to do that, if somewhat. And I think that times are ripe now. I'm amazed. The people that, when I was involved in politics over 20 years ago, the people that were looked at as radical, crazy people are now friends of Donald Trump, and he's putting them in positions of power. I've been reading about these things. So we needn't get discouraged. The things that we believe in 25 years will be at the forefront and in power. And the militia is certainly part of our Constitution. And if we, Justice Story was right, if we just paid attention to it, then these four militia clauses, we might be, it would go a long way to getting our freedoms back and putting government at bay. That's what the militia is all about, keeping government at bay, keeping them humble, keeping them scared of the people. Because, as is said, I see it on bumper stickers, well, where people fear the government, you have tyranny. Where the government fears people, you have liberty, and it's going to be one or the other. No, there's no working together with government, because they will get the upper hand. It doesn't work that way. That's what our founders believe, and we should believe the same thing. Matter of fact, they said that very thing over and over and over again. So the militia is what's put in our Constitution to create that environment of fear. And if there's anything that government people and bureaucrats fear, it's losing their jobs or being humiliated. They fear all that. They fear political consequences. That's what they fear more than anything. And they live in constant fear, by the way, most of them. And the militia then plays on that. You know, our constitutional understanding, our common law, is all about understanding the frailties of men and pitting the frailties of men in government against one another so that government will not overwhelm us. That's what James Madison said, and he was right.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, look, it's getting late, so let me move over to an open forum and hang in there if anybody's got any questions for you. Gerard, are you ready to take this? Anybody wants to get into the queue, star six?
Yeah.
You there, Gerard?
Yeah,
hey,
did you
see the message I put in your Skype?
No. I was probably busy.
You take a look. Just put a K in there when you see it.
Right.
You should look now.
Okay.
All right, you got it.
All right, I just wanted to say something. You know, I had a question, I guess, from last week's call, and it had to do with the committees of safety. Now, I never knew what a committee of safety was before NLA, and then we had Burns, and they started a committee of safety, and I think that was like the first time I had heard about that. And what's his name, Chris Bryles, and those people there had done extensive research. And we come to find out that, you know, it was something that was in our heritage way back when, and there was a fact that all the signers of the Declaration of Independence belonged to a committee of safety. So that being said, you know, obviously they felt a need for what was going on with the troops around them, probably even as much more than so than even what we feel, although it's getting worse every day. In order to have some kind of a structure outside of the local government in order to discuss these things and make plans, you know, on how to battle them. So, you
and
know,
remember that the committee, just make a note here, remember that the committees of safety morphed into the committeemen.
Right.
And so their job went from one job to get government under control and back under the chains, and then it went to keeping them there. But then we lost it.
But somebody reminded me, and they said, look, during the French Revolution, the committees of safety were part of the Reign of Terror, and they ruled, the committees of safety took over and ruled with tyranny for like 10 months. And I was like, well, gee, I didn't know that. I didn't realize that. I know the French Revolution was not what it set out to be. It was turned on its head. And, you know, it certainly didn't produce the results that the American Revolution did. I think the factions got in there and turned it on its head and took advantage of that vacuum. And anytime you have anybody that sets themselves up in a position of power, and that includes the common law grand jury and the committee man, or anybody can be subverted and use that power for no good. So I wouldn't just because the committees of safety in France took a bad turn because I guess they had a powerful guy that took over, and he basically what he did is he set himself up probably as that dictator that ruled them and then went around. Because they were having a revolution and the powers were shaken and you know there was anarchy that existed and in that vacuum he took over with his committee of safety and he ran unchecked, I guess. I didn't look into it, but it didn't, you know, I basically, you know, just skimmed it. But nevertheless, it was a committee of safety idea went wrong, and I wanted to just address that look, at anything we do, because we're men, it can always go wrong. We have pride, envy, jealousy, hate in us, and that's why in this country we run with the law and we run with the lawgiver, that it's not up to men's opinions. We follow that plan. So that's the whole idea, and as long as we do that, then our feet are on level ground. So I wanted to address that because some people may say, oh, you're being subversive. You're doing like they did in the French Revolution with committees of safety. Well, our forefathers saw the need to do it too. So in the right context, it can do the right thing. It's like anything else. Look at too much. You hyperventilate too much. Too much air will make you pass out. Too much water will drown you. Not enough will kill you. So it's that balancing act that you have to consider.
Gerard.
Anyway. Yes.
Also, one other point about that, you know, look at committees of safety, that whatever they were doing, they were abusing even the name, because committee of safety is supposed to be for the safety of the people. And, I mean, that's the whole point of it. But we can see how that could be hijacked. I mean, I know of liberty groups that were hijacked by people who are just sick individuals and take people down the wrong road, but they have the charisma and so on and so forth, and their work is really power. They saw power. So I've seen that even in liberty groups, and so, yeah, it's going to happen even in committees of safety. I can see how it could happen. But, you see, That's why what we put together was so important, to try to take some kind of a control to give them the principles. Because if they got the principles and they come in with principles and they agree to principles, the sense of honor, sense of justice, a sense of mercy, and take an oath to that and then build their committees of safety, you know, they got something to build upon that someone else can say, wait a second here, you're going down the wrong road. You took an oath to be honorable, or you took an oath to be merciful, or whatever the case may be. You see, now you can bring it back to where it belongs. Because
well,
we have a sense of agreement
look
on principles.
Too, that was thought of, and this is where the chairman is shifted out every 6 months to a year, so there's not that time to take over like that. Also, the fact that every member has as much authority as the leadership does. And so
I imagine in France they took advantage. And, you know, the trouble is people are used to being slaves. And so what happens is they always gravitate to somebody who they perceive as a leader. And this guy then has the potential to take over the group. And if they're weak, that's what happens. And look, there's a phenomenon in this country. If you look at the names of the different government organizations, they do the exact opposite of what they're supposed to be doing. You know, I mean, even the names they give, like to subvert a committee of safety and make it a committee of terror, isn't that what goes on in society today? You know, they give the definition of terrorism, and if you look at these ABC agencies, they fit the perfect their definition of terrorist. So, I mean,
absolutely.
Look at, they call our justice system the criminal justice system. They're not kidding. It is criminal. Anyway, nevertheless, you get the idea.
Yeah. The other thing, too, am I on? Can you hear me, Gerard?
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, the other thing, too, in France, they weren't trying to establish what was already there. They were just trying to subvert. They wanted to strangle every priest with the guts of every king, or the other way around, vice versa. They wanted to throw all religion out, which is an impossibility. Our separation from Britain didn't have anything to do with that. We didn't want to subvert government, and like you say, a vacuum came up. Then what do you do? We didn't do that. All of our governments just stayed right where they were. All of our courts stayed where they were. We just said we want the common law in our courts, we want it in our government, and everything just stayed pretty much the way it was. And if we have problems in America again, fortunately, the way things are set up, I think that we'll just come out of it smelling good and organized, whereas France didn't have that. France has a history of nothing but revolution, and their law, under the Roman law, and of course they had it in their religion too, the same law. They were comfortable with the idea of a dictator. And so that's what they wanted. And it was a anti-God revolution from the start. The committees of safety wanted to strangle the priest with the guts of every king, and every prince, his guts the other way around. And that was their cry. That's the difference. Here we were talking about we want to put God on the throne, and that's what men were saying. Over there they were saying we want to put a prostitute in the Cathedral of Notre Dame and worship her, and they did. They put a prostitute, a hooker, naked in the Cathedral of Notre Dame and threw God out and said we worship you. So there's the grand difference between the two, and I like to think that we aren't so far gone. But you make the point, of course, men are men. But if we have those sensibilities, that won't happen. And certainly, we have the machinery in place to keep that from happening. We just want to reestablish the courts we already have, make our juries stronger. We've still got all the – we're all armed here, too, by the way. So we've got a lot of things going for us.
Okay. Thank you very much, Brent. Okay. I'm going to go ahead and open up it looks like they're open. North Carolina, is that April?
Yes.
Go ahead. You're unmuted, April.
Hi. Well, I'm new to this. Thank you. I was listening to quite a bit. I have a couple questions. One, I have the same situation where my son is imprisoned for things he didn't do, and I'm trying to fight for him, and I wanted to know if there was anyone out there who could help me at some time figure out what papers I got to file and what I got to do. The other thing is, with what you're filing with the president, I was wondering if there was anything in there that had to do with protecting our rights to self-medicate with natural substances.
You know what? I do believe that we talked about the stuff in the foods and our right for that in the Coruanto that we put out, which is all look at everything we filed is on our site under docket. And some of the more important stuff was like the first Coruanto we filed, which I believe is a we command. You know, the mandamus, I believe, is by what authority, and the Coruanto is where you actually command them. And it's actually a court case, which they didn't realize. That's the opening of a court case. And in that Coruanto, we talked about forced vaccinations and all that stuff, I believe. So what you should do is you should go back through there and read all that stuff. I mean, this paper tonight is a very instructional paper. And don't forget to read the footnotes, because the footnotes explain a lot of what, you know, if you're reading, you see where we got it from. And, you know, much of what we put in the paperwork is not even our own sentences or words.
Does that have to do with, like, here's an example. My son recently got cancer, and after he went through chemo, I did some research on cures for cancer, and I actually found out that the government, over 68 years ago, actually did this, numerous testing on cannabis and found out cannabis actually kills cancer without damaging the good cells, and yet they still make it illegal. And it really made me irate, because my son is 23 years old, never been married, and now they took away his chance to have kids, and he's still getting sick from all of this. They joked about it in the hospital, called it poison in a bag. And it's horrible, and I'm so mad that they made it illegal. But the other thing is, I stopped going to pain clinics because I started self-medicating with something called kratom. I don't know if you're familiar with it. And kratom is a natural herb, and it's in the coffee family. And I was going to pain clinics over 10 years, and it actually made me feel worse going to take in the prescribed drugs, where with the kratom, which is now a new, it's a new craze going on, and it's been in countries for centuries, and it's been here for quite a while now, too. Federal government tried to make it illegal September 30th, and so many people spoke up that they haven't made it illegal yet. They're in a watching phase. So that's why I was asking if there was anything in there to help fight for our rights to self-medicate ourselves with what we feel is safe, instead of, like you were saying, with the vaccinations. It's just horrible what they're doing to our children.
Yeah, it is in there, and there's so much out there that's coming. You know, they can't stop it anymore, because this thing called the internet really, really woke people up. And there was 7 states that passed cannabis growth and use this past election. So it's out there. I mean, now if you're a cancer patient, you could look at. I'd go move there if I thought it was going to heal me, and that's where I had to go. At least you can go someplace now. Most of the good cures ended up running to Mexico and Germany, outside of this country. They really got it in for us, as far as if, you know, when you say they're in a waiting stage, what they're doing is waiting for the pharmaceutical companies to complain louder. In other words, when it starts cutting into their profits, they'll make a law against it.
Exactly.
And as sad as it is to say, many of these politicians are making money on the illegal drug trade, and they wouldn't want it legal because it would cut into their profits. The price would go down. You know, it's just so ugly on every spectrum. And I believe that the good Lord left us a cure in every plant and every herb for every ill that we have. And most of the ills we have are all self-inflicted. It has to do with poor nutrition and bad habits and all those things. You know, most of what we do is self-inflicted. And it's a matter of a lifestyle change and a nutrition change. And there's real medicine out there. I've studied homeopathy for years and nutrition, and my children never went to a doctor. Let me tell you what, that's a battle, because when you don't take your kids to a doctor, they got you down as an abuser. You know, and I ended up homeschooling them, so I'm a real fringe. You know, I'm one of them nuts, you know. And then I joined National Liberty Alliance, and I became a paper terrorist, of all things. They actually call us a paper terrorist.
Yeah.
And whatever that means. I told the guy that told me that, he's in some kind of a the National Guard thing, and he works with the Homeland Security. He says, hey, you know what they call you guys? They say you're paper terrorists. I said, well, you go back and you tell them Apria said that's right because we write constitutional papers that they can't answer, and they're terrorized. And you tell him there's not, there, I'm not afraid of any of them. There's only one thing I'm afraid of, and that's a lit match. But anyway, look, at this country's ready for a change. And I don't know what happened with Donald Trump, but my feeling is that he didn't choose. He was chosen. And yeah, I don't even believe he was all that honorable or anything when he went in there. He was just a normal guy, but he was untouched by them. He was and when he went in and saw what he saw, I believe he had a change. I think he drank from that cup and tasted that cup, and he has a vision now, just like Kennedy did. Because when Kennedy came in, I don't think he realized what he was up against. And then he decided to do something about it, and you see what happened to him. You know, the minute you go after the dollar, the Federal Reserve, right, that's a death sentence with these guys. Yeah. And so that's why we have to support anything he does with our monetary system. It's going to be very important that we stick together. Look, we have the benefit of history now. We're not ignorant. You know, I asked my parents, I said, you know, when Kennedy made that speech, and then he was dead in a week or whatever, I said, didn't you guys wonder? And they said, I don't know. You know, I think they were in shock. And they came from, and my parents kind of still had that naive belief in the government, that the government would never do anything to harm us. It was my country, right or wrong, blah, blah, one nation under God, which they weren't already back that time. Of course, it was very well hidden. And there were still more good people in office, so they had, you know, they had a somewhat of a credible face. But to me, you know, to hear that speech that he gave and some of the other stuff that he said, and then to let the investigation go, and then what happens I think it was the eve of Pearl Harbor, the releasing of the records that they sealed. In Pearl Harbor, they sealed them for 60 years, and when the 60 years was up, they resealed them for another 60 years. Now, what goes on in this country that you got to seal records for 120 years? Well, they screwed up because 9/11 was on the anniversary of Pearl Harbor, which I believe was a false flag. I believe that Roosevelt knew they were coming. He needed to get us in that war, and their blood sacrifice was almost the same number that we lost in 9/11, which was between 2,000 and 3,000 people. And they do, you know what? One thing about the evil empire, they never change their MO. They do the same thing year in, year out. They march forward. They know what they know, and that's what they know. And that's their weakness for us. You can really get to know what they're going to do and what their next step is. My goodness, they tell you, they brag about it. It's all over the place. So if we can't grab them like a bull by the nose and get them under control right now, we'll never do it. This is our chance to prove that we're choosing the light. That God said, if my people who call themselves by my name turn their face to me, this is our chance right now to do that. The amount that we get involved in turning this government back to its roots is the amount of help that we're going to get from on high. I believe it's up to us to make the choice.
When he got elected, I felt relief that night. That was the first night I actually went to sleep thinking that my children have hope for a future.
Well, I know there was probably more prayers than ever went on in a nation that night, and it was a miracle because I believe that all those computers were compromised. I believe they had their programs in them. And I think it was a miracle that it just didn't get overturned. I mean, they were truly, truly surprised. You can't fake this stuff. You can't make this stuff up. You know what I mean? And so
I was told by somebody that she bought the election and she was winning.
Yeah. Well, there were people in places that she didn't, you know, they don't understand that the resistance is deeper than they think it is. We have people all over the place, inside, outside, and they just underestimated the will of the people. And there were people watching, and everybody did their part. And only God can construct something like that. You know, sometimes you look at the evil that's going on, you say, you know that there's a almost a supreme evil being, because how could somebody make all this stuff fit in different places, different times, different people? It's almost impossible. You have to have, I don't know, how could you hold it together other than the fact that, you know, he's setting things up that run by themselves in this corner, but they all seem to dovetail so perfectly into marching us down the road to perdition. And it's really very discouraging when you understand the length and breadth and scope of the conspiracy that's been put in place and how much we've bit into it. And really, you know, it's our own computers that have put us here. It's our own laxity, you know.
Yeah.
We've been lax and we're paying the price, but look, it's time to wipe the nose and spank the kid and put him to bed and get things back in order again.
You know, I've been telling everybody that a saying that was said to a friend of mine once in court was, ignorance is no excuse. And I say that it's so true. It's time to be unignorant. It's time to get educated. And it's time to take back our courts. And you were talking about Virginia earlier. You said something about the Constitution not being recognized there. I'm in certain places in Virginia. Please tell me that's not in Virginia Beach, because that's where they have my son.
Oh, it's not recognized anywhere almost. I mean, they're not recognized. Who's recognizing it? Tell me what judge that you know of recently that has held up the Constitution.
They're horrible. They don't even do due process. They do nothing. They're taking 12, 15-year-old cases now that are cold cases, and if there's DNA from them, they're prosecuting the people on them, and they're convicting them with no proof, no evidence, no nothing. And I know this for a fact that they're doing this. While my son was in their jail, there was a guy with him that is a federal forensic expert, and because he refused to plant evidence, they put charges against him that were false, and they convicted him and gave him time.
Yeah, they're really evil, and that's what they've been doing, and it's widespread all over the place.
Yeah.
And you know, of course, look, you don't hear about the victories because they don't want you to hear about them. So those are kept quiet. I mean, if there is a good judge out there doing a good thing, you know, either they get rid of him, or it's just, you know, they hide the news, they don't report it. So, but that's how they died the death of a thousand cuts here, because they really didn't even look at what was really going on. They believed their own lie is what happened, and they got complacent, and that's why they fell. But you know, we can't relax now, because you know, we might have knocked them back on their heels, but you know, once they get leaning forward and they get their toes in the mat, they're not gonna lay down easy. Believe me, evil never does. We got a little reprieve here, but we have to go forward. And you need to educate yourself. We have lots of resources, and you know, and you can go on and talk to people on our in the site, and we have a court access court. But the best thing is to read all those papers, you know, and get yourself familiar with what's going on. And hopefully, as we move forward with this, with the paperwork and the stuff we're doing, your job will become easier, because we'll make changes at that level, that when you come in with a paper that is constructed in a way that is lawful, you know, and not only legal but lawful, they'll start to recognize these things. And I think what's going to happen is, when they finally start to realize that the common law is alive and the Constitution is alive, I think those people that are in there first are going to have the best victories, because they're going to fall over themselves to do the right thing when they see that paper, because they want to get on the bandwagon. Once they realize that the wave is going the other way and they need to jump on it, then people like yourselves that are trying to get in are going to have maybe some kind of miraculous results in the beginning. That's my belief anyway, you know, because they're going to be looking to do the right thing. You know what I mean? And look, at when you see a paper that is common law, common sense, that is full of the, you know, the law, the Constitution, you know, honor, justice, and mercy, it's so recognizable. It's like turning a flashlight in the dark. So right. They're going to know those papers. I mean, already we, around here, you know, the first reputation we got was they told the police, don't bring any of them National Liberty Alliance people into court. If you pull them over and you know they're in that organization, don't write them any tickets that come to court because they don't want us in court. Because we take up too much of their time. We make them answer. It's a money-making deal. If everybody just said, I won't plead, and I want a trial, and I want a common law trial, their court, that whole system would close down in a month.
Yep.
They'd be done.
Yep.
Because they can't handle it.
I'm telling everybody, don't plead. Everybody I talk to, my son's in Red Onion Prison right now. He puts people on the phone with me all the time, and I don't know why because I'm just starting to learn this. But the first thing I say is don't plead.
Do not plead. You let the judge say something, and then you ask him if he's acting as a lawyer.
Well,
and if
you've
he says
know what
that
you're
he's
doing,
not guilty,
though.
You say thank you.
Yeah, they got a lot of nasty tricks, though. So if you don't plead, you got to know how to not get held in contempt and not get sent to a mental institution because you're crazy and they want to have you examined and maybe pump you full of drugs while they got you there. Say, yep, he's crazy. You know, they do that. That's one of their tactics. So just be careful.
Yeah.
Anyway, stay in touch. You know, there's lots of people out there that can help you. But the first thing is nobody can help you go into the courts if you don't educate yourself because nobody here has the ability or the authority to go into court and speak for you. They don't let other people do that for other people. So what happens is you can write all the paperwork you want, but they've gotten to know common law people. And what the judges do is they know other people are filling out paperwork for other people. So what they'll do is they'll get you in court and they get you in front of him, and he'll start questioning you to see what you know.
Right.
And then not only to see what you know, but also to trap you, to get you to stick your foot in your mouth and say something on the record that pulls you into a jurisdiction where you don't want to be. So you really have to have – look, if nothing else, you have to know enough to keep your mouth shut and just say, I object. And why? Yep. Because it's not my wish. Whatever you say, get out of there and put it in the paperwork later. They're never going to hold
watching,
you to on paperwork.
I've been watching Bill Thornton's videos over and over and over again because I want to embed it in my brain.
There you go. So you already started the right path, and that is the right path, to get to get the common law in your heart. Once it's in your heart, what you'll find out is that you're going to be able to defend it, and you won't even have to think about it. It'll just come out. And no judge will be able to trip you up because, look, at all your life they trained you to think like a slave. Their system works because it's self-policing. That's why it works. So once you break out of that matrix and pull that pipe out of the back of your head and stop having them program your thoughts, that's the beginning to liberty and freedom, is to thinking for yourself. But that's my advice. If you're doing the right thing, you're educating yourself first, then you can form alliances with people in here. Some people are better writers, you know what I mean? Maybe you can get somebody to help you write a paper, but you're going to have to do that. We don't do it anymore because there's such a demand. It's so hard to do, and we can't follow that case through in good conscience for the type of care that it would need to follow it all the way through. But the more people that get trained and the more papers we put in as a group, it's going to help the little guy when he comes in. And I really, really believe that now. I think we're right on the precipice of that. So
anyway. I want to put a perfect paper together, and then I want to help other people. I know a lot of other parents out there, and they're in the same situation, and I want to help them. Once I have it and I put it in and implement it, then I want to help them with it.
Right.
So that's my goal. I want to continue what y'all are doing. I want to fight for our country.
Well,
I believe God put me down this road for a reason, and He also put me in the path of CPS too. My grandson is in CPS, and I've seen the injustice going on there too. So I've seen a lot of injustice going on, and I don't like it. And I know God wants me to do something about it, or He wouldn't have put these situations in my hands.
That's right. There's no coincidences. I really believe that.
Me too.
Well, thanks a lot, April. It's good hearing from you, and we'll look forward to hearing from you in the future.
And right. Thank you. I love hearing from all of you. I'm learning a lot. Thank you all.
Yeah. Somebody said my name. Yeah. Who was that?
Can you hear me,
yeah.
Gerard?
Yes, I can.
This is Jan. What John is referring to about there is no constitution is the constitutional free zone that's 100 miles wide and extends inland from every boundary. So any of the sea coast, like Virginia, is totally within that. So there is no constitutional guarantees for anybody in Virginia. New Jersey and Maryland and Delaware and up and down the coast and so on.
Oh, God.
So only the states that are not bordered, you know, have a constitution left. Sorry.
Hey, Jan, is that as the crow flies or is that by the road?
That's the crow flies.
Because I think I'm about a mile and a half one way or the other on that deal. I'm setting my gun up right on the boundary.
Yep.
You know, how about if we shoot from our constitutional zone into your no constitutional zone? What's that?
That's a good idea.
Anyway, thank you.
Sure.
Okay, we'll take our next. Thank you, April, and thank you, Jan. Next question. Yeah, there's no name, so I'll unmute you, and you can give us your name and your state. The last four numbers, excuse me, I don't have my glasses on. Looks like 7109, perhaps.
It's Julie in Montana.
Hey, Julie, how you doing?
Good, how are you?
Good. So what's
I was
going
wondering
on tonight?
About, you know, I have a guy that's trying to get me to write a habeas corpus, and I'm wondering if the national group is going to pick those up again, pick up doing that again.
Well, look at all the ones we filed, we're going to refile under this case number. So I don't know what's going to happen with that, but it's going to be good because they're going to have to answer it.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, whatever happens on the heels of that can only be better, you know.
Right.
I mean, because once we hold our feet to the fire, we only need, you know, one example to go in and do the deal, and they'll get the picture really quickly after that, you know. Mm-hmm. So what I would say is just go ahead and I don't know if you know if you went through the instructionals on it, you know what I mean? We used to have a place where you put your information in and figured out, you know, what type of habeas corpus you needed and that stuff to get your paperwork ready, you know. But we have, like, I think we've already got something like 40-something of them, you know, that have been sent into the court. Of course, they stick them in a file, in a miscellaneous file. They're not putting them where they belong. So those are the ones that will be refiled in this new case, and then we'll see what happens with them. But you should, you know, you should get ready. You should do anyway. I mean, if you knew how to, it's difficult to do for yourself because when you do it for yourself, you have to open a court of record. You got to know how to do that. Normally, you ask the judge's permission. You know, we've done them before. John did one on his own, you know, where he did it as a court of record. There was no asking. He just went in and did it as the court of record. And they did release the guy afterwards. So I don't know. You know, most of the time, the judge will never give you one. If you follow their procedure to do it, you'll never get it. If you're waiting for them to give you permission, it's like asking permission to poke them in the eye. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So
and you have to go to the higher courts too. You have to go to the higher courts with them, right?
Yeah, because it's a violation of unalienable rights. It's a due process violation. So you end up in a federal court because that's what their jurisdiction is on that. You know what I mean? It's pretty hard for the state to correct themselves when they're the ones being the aggressor. You know what I'm saying? So I don't know how, you know, the state could give you redress if you had a judge that was understood that the breaking of the Constitution had dismissed your case and let you go, but usually they'll never take a case and rule for you in the state court. You usually have to go in the federal court, which is a whole nother story, you know. And like Brent says, most lawyers don't like to go to federal court because the judges beat them up pretty bad and sanction them. I think you know, pro se litigants do better because they're not. I think the going in as a bar attorney is an impediment. You know, they know that you're an officer of the court, and they know how to pull your chain. And so I think when people go in on their own, I think they do better than they do with an attorney, unless the guy is really good and he knows a lot of people. You know, it's just harder for them to deal with. And don't forget, you know, when you go in as a pro se litigant, one of the reasons, or not even pro se, because it's one of their terms that brings you in their jurisdiction. But right. You know, if you go in self-represented, whatever you want to call it, sui juris, I don't know. The judge has a certain obligation to make sure the lawyers don't abuse you. And that's one reason they don't like it, because he actually has to watch what's going on, which they just want to collect a check and they don't really want to get involved. And when you come in without an attorney to take the blame, you know, the judge has a certain responsibility to you to make sure that they're not abusing you and frauding you and doing all that stuff. So they would just as soon rather not have you there.
Yeah, so they don't follow that rule, though.
Well, you look at if you do good paperwork and you speak well and you handle yourself well, you'll do well, because they'll do whatever they can do to get you out of there. You know, you got to give him something to hang his hat on, and he will. He will not want to stick his neck out, and certainly not for a lower court judge. So, you know,
so
you have
to
dance the dance.
Physically. I have to go before the court physically with the habeas corpus in the federal court?
Well, you have to file it, you know, it depends. I don't know what his situation is, you know what I mean? Like, if somebody's in jail, it has to be filed with the jailer, but it also has to be filed with the court, the federal district court, you know what I mean? And so you don't have to go there, but you need the person that you're filing it for, you need... Number one, you need like a next friend that can do the affidavit to speak for the person, because they can't do the paperwork because they're in court. That's what the next friend's all about. Now, you don't actually have to show up physically there. This is all going to be done by paperwork and by service, you know. I mean, if you're going to show up physically, that means they're delivering the prisoner. That would be a good thing, I think, you know. And should that happen, you should make some phone calls right away and make sure you have help there. You know what I mean? I mean, if they're going to show up with the prisoner, and actually, they'll never answer the charges. You know, they'll either just let them go or you know, I mean, right now their biggest strategy is to not answer anything, and they think mm-hmm. they can get away with that. So that's what this next step is holding their feet to the fire for not answering. And that's why I say, you know, you're all these cases that are coming in after the fact may become, the timing might just be perfect for you, because you won't have to go through what all the other poor people went through, you know, beating on the door to get in. Like, you know, we're very close to getting this thing recognized and realized, and you're coming in just at the right time. You know, every timing and the right time and the right season is now. Mm-hmm. So I have a lot of hope for that, and you should too. So anyway, I can't talk about the particulars of the habeas corpus. We got plenty of stuff online to educate yourself. And right now, we're not writing them. We don't have anybody doing them, because we were overwhelmed with them. We couldn't take any more on it. It got to be crazy. I mean, how many can we handle, you know? But
yeah.
All the information is still up there, and we're certainly willing to give you some type of advice, you know? And like I said, you and the last caller, it's important to educate yourself, because it's going to require at some point, you know, your footwork, you know, and maybe even you speaking if you had to. Not a whole lot, but you got to have enough savvy to hold your place in court and not stick your foot in your mouth, and then, you know, get out of there unscathed and write your next paper. You know what I mean? And it's not as hard as it sounds.
I've had a lot of experience in court doing that very thing. So.
Well, then you're good. You should be old hat, you know.
Yeah.
So believe me, it's a journey. It's a journey, and you know, when it works out, it's actually nice. It feels good when you win, you know. And I the wins we have and the wins that I've had, I savor to this day. They tasted very sweet. They still taste sweet. I want more. You know? So that's where I'm at. Okay.
I wanted to ask John if I can call him to I would like to try and make arrange a conference call with an important person in Montana that I'd like, you know, like him to talk to. And I've just recently acquired his you know, his office phone number. And
well, so, does this person want to talk to us, or you? I mean, usually what we do is, you know, if you explain to somebody who we are and they have an interest, then what we'll do is they can call John, because we don't run around looking for people, you know what I'm saying?
Well, I wanted to talk to John about it first before I contact him. And he's a pastor in Montana, in the northwest corner of Montana, and he has a he's just a real influential person, and he's got his church is, you know, he's got a free church, I guess you could call it, without, you know.
Yeah, I bet you I know who it is, but I'm not going to mention his name. Look, you can call John during the week and try him during the day, like midday, and try him on that 233 number. I think it's 845-233-6560, if I'm not mistaken. And you can get him to pick up and talk about it. You know what I mean? And as far as, I mean, you're gonna if it's who I think it is, you're gonna need to see him first. You know,
yeah.
And show him who we are and what we are. I mean, I would not attempt to approach him on a cold call, so to speak. You know what I mean?
Well, I actually met him about 4 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So. I've been wanting to get a hold of him, and so I finally got a hold of somebody that is friends with him. So
mm-hmm.
He gave me the number.
Yeah, I don't look at. He kind of dropped off the radar, you know. If it's who I think it is, he moved from Florida out to there. He had a big, big church in Florida, and then he moved out there, and then he kind of went off
him.
The radar. And I thought that maybe he got threatened or something, because he. You didn't hear anything, and there was nothing going on. I mean, there was a lot of people that were wanting to follow him and stuff. And I know two people from this area where I live that moved out there in hopes of joining up with him. And they didn't have very good luck once they got out there. Things had changed. And so I don't know what's going on or where he's at. I do know his work, though. He's got some really good work. He's got some really good, you know, I don't want to say it's as much preaching as what we do. I mean, he preached the Constitution. He preached, it, you know, in as far as God's law is in it, and he made good points, you know, and he was very powerful. So I don't know what happened, but, you know, when you get somebody that starts to get very popular and have a lot of people, those are the people that they focus their wrath on the most, you know. So maybe they got to him. I don't know. You know, even Ron Paul, when he reached his height, you saw him back off. His wife got sick, and I seriously suspect that they did something, and they told him next time we won't, you know, I think something happened with his wife.
Yeah.
And
well,
they said next.
I think something happened with him, too. It was very obvious that he did an about-face. Yeah.
Yeah, they got to him. And look, knowing what I know about Ron Paul, the character of the man, he would have never caved for himself. It had to be that they threatened his family, because I know he's fearless, and I know he's not doing stuff for himself. It's for the love of his family, and you can't blame him, you know.
Yeah.
Are you gonna, you know, and that's why, like right now, I think the time is right, because there's this wave, and people like Ron Paul and these different pastors and stuff who've kind of been whacked down and their heads been pushed down, their heads aren't going to come up until they look around and see the people standing up. You know, same thing with your constitutional sheriffs. They need the people to stand up. When people start standing up, you'll see other people, you'll see the leaders come out of the woodwork, and especially those leaders that tried to lead and they were knocked back, and so they're like, you know, twice shy almost, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So,
well, this pastor has a newsletter that he puts out that I'm you know, I'm on that. So, you know, he's not.
So you're up with his latest stuff then. I lost contact with him and I haven't seen anything recently. So you know more about him than I do. And so, you know, it's if you wanna have him, I would just show him what we're doing, show him our paperwork, see what he thinks. Look at if he's of the mind to, he'll come around. And I mean, he's got good stuff. I mean, we would even I dare say that he's good enough to be a speaker every now and then too. You know what I mean? Because I know his stuff. His stuff is very good.
Yeah.
So, anyway, we're not going to have a meeting with him unless he's already, you know, we're not going to do a cold call with him. I'll tell you that right now. He needs to look at our stuff and come to a conclusion.
John first, and then I would call him, and then I would suggest that we do a three-way call or something.
Right, so, right.
Yeah, it wouldn't be a cold call or anything.
Yeah, that's the best way. Yeah. Good. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Have a good evening.
You too.
Okay, you're welcome. I'm going to the next caller.
We're up to about 12:20.
Oh, it's that late? I guess I better, I lost track of time. We should
close.
You're
just having too much fun.
I didn't, you know, once you get me yapping. Well, you know, John did the same thing tonight. I'm not going to stay on long.
Right.
But listen, is that Ward? John Ward? Go ahead. You got like 2 minutes. Go ahead, and then we'll close out. I'm sorry.
Yeah,
I can't go on here.
This is he in Alaska. I won't take long. I have not yet read the 36-page article on the redress of grievances, but one major redress that is needed for we the people to have remedy from what the old de facto governments have done is to return all our natural rights, and most emphatically with them would be all our rights to our property, which has been presumptively stolen from us through the all caps names and their corporate franchise accounts built around our birth documents. This would include our real...
That is in there. We addressed all of that to them. Yes.
Oh, they did. They did.
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yes. But, and it's in... Look, we're refiling everything we file. So some of that is in the original Corwanto. But look, the paper's long. You should go read it. Read, the whole thing. And then there's a couple of them that came before. And actually, I do believe that we even broke them down by title of the subject, like what you're saying. And so some of them are broken down that you can tell what they talk about by their title. Go in and read them. We're refiling all of those. So there'll be no excuse for them not to know what where we're coming from and what we're talking about. I mean, we get into the Judiciary Act, the whole deal. We go right back to 1776 forward and the fingers that were in there from that time that caused the subversion of what we're talking about now. You know.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So
well,
it's in there. Yep. You know, when we read some of Anna von Ritz's paperwork, she laid out the whole scam that they did. And as much as Anna von Ritz is what she is, and we don't agree with her methodology, I don't know who did her research, but the way that she laid out the timeline. See, I knew every piece of what she wrote, I knew about. But I never, you know, until you sit down and you lay it out like a story on a timeline like that, you know, it was very eye-opening to see how each piece fit into the next. You know, a lot of it I lived, and I didn't. And when you're living through something, you got to stand back and look at it in history and in time. And I guess I'm getting a little longer in the tooth, so I'm able to do that a little bit more now because some of it is actual firsthand experience. Well, the last one to know what's going on is the people that are going through it. You know what I mean? So that was pretty good layout she had of what really happened and how it was done and the actors involved. That was very, and we've checked it into it. It's historically correct. And so we use that. We actually quoted her paper in our paper. You know, because look at anything that's good that we can verify, we'll use of somebody else's. You know what I'm saying? I mean, we're not
sure that's good.
We're not proud to where, you know, it has to come from us. You know, and as a matter of fact, most of the time we're always citing our sources. So anyway, we, you know, as much as we fought and banged heads with her, we did use that particular layout, which we had anyway, but the way it was laid out, I think it flowed really nicely for people to read and understand how we got to where we are today. And so, yes, that is definitely going to be in there. And I don't want to go on too much longer. I got to shut this recording off. It's been a good night, and look, we'll continue next week. We've got a lot of exciting stuff going on. We got to watch now. Now's not the time to let that lamp run out of oil, because we got to keep our eye on the ball here, because it's bouncing, you know, and it's up to us to grab it and get the rebound. That's where we're at. We need to take the next shot at the three-pointer. It's up to us. Ball's in our court now. Okay.
Now, I'll go ahead and read this 36-page article and take it from there. Thank you very much, John.
You're welcome. Yeah. Have a good night. God bless everybody. Thanks for coming. I'm going to stop the recording.